Gina, Judy, it's all for you.
You know we got Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show.
I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!
I don't want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I can drag it to the bathroom and drown in the bathtub.
You bet I cut the taxes at the top.
How dare you? How dare you?
Go ahead. Make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now.
Welcome, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, lovers of freedom, fairness, and democracy, truth, justice, the American way. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight on the big program. It is Our Future Friday. Our friend Isaiah Poole from the Campaign for America's Future is going to be here talking about jobs and the idea that we are one. You know, as the attacks have come across almost every state for workers, you are seeing people, you're seeing people move together. You're seeing a unification, if you will. When I was in Wisconsin, I was amazed to see some of the fault lines that had been in the labor movement, some of the groups that may not have gotten along with each other coming together, realizing that truly, all working people must be one. So it'll be interesting to talk with Isaiah. Also in the second hour, Pennsylvania State Representative Mike Sterla will be here talking about the idea of stopping the war on workers, talking about really sanity, rational thought, good governance, what we should be doing to actually move the state forward instead of moving us back to the 1890s where people had virtually no rights. Also in the second hour, Ted Smuckler, public policy director for the Interfaith Worker Justice Organization, going to be talking about the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire today, the 100th anniversary of 146 young women burned to death, or folks who were, you know, jumped out of windows to get away from the flames, all because the factory owner feared that someone might stick a scrap off the floor in their pocket. So they chained the doors shut so that nobody could get out. And we're going to talk also how things have changed throughout the years. Things have gotten better, but you know what? There are still workplaces in this country that are safe. Statistics say some 50,000 people per year die of occupational illness. So that'll be interesting. Also, in the third hour, Professor Kenneth Mash is going to be here from East Stroudsburg University talking about Monday's big protest. Of course, here on Monday, 11:30 a.m., on the steps of the Capitol, there's going to be a rally to fund higher education, because I think they're right. You know, underfunded, we fail. And if we continue down this road that the governor has laid out for us, this $1 billion cut to K through 12 education, this 54% cut to higher education, leads to very bad things. Very, very bad. Also, your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. So this week also, you know, along with being the 100th anniversary of the
triangle shirtwaist fire, this horrible disaster that really shaped labor law for the next 50 to 75 years. And even to today, it is looked at as one of those moments where we decided that a government had a role in protecting workers on the job, had a role in ensuring that people had the opportunity to bargain, to have a say. And, you know, because going back, the lesson learned from that, and I'm sure we'll get into this later, the lesson learned from it is, you know, if you don't have a seat at the table to negotiate, you're basically on the menu. You're basically at the will of someone else. And that's something that has to be talked about. This week, also this week was the 1 year anniversary of healthcare. And you know what? The world didn't stop turning. It isn't the end of the world. The sun was bright and beautiful today. It was a gorgeous day, even though a year ago they told us it would be all over. Much like the cuckoos that I meet down on the street telling me May 21st is the end of the world. And much like they've been predicting Armageddon and the end of the world, oh my God, it's socialism and all of this, the sun still came up and the world still turned. It didn't happen. Good news today, though. If you look at the great state of Vermont, and I love Vermont. You know, my wife and I have a special place in our heart for Vermont. That's where we were married. We ran away like two kids. I was 30. We ran away like two kids, eloped off to Vermont. Beautiful place. Honeymooned at Ben and Jerry's. They had a little factory there. But a beautiful, beautiful state. They are going to be the first state in the country to live up to their federal mandate. And they've started their exchange. According to the AP, the Vermont House of Representatives voted Thursday to approve a bill that would have established a statewide health care marketplace. The bill would set the state on a path toward universal care and cost containment. The vote was 89-47 to make sure that folks have the health care that they need. It went on. Another bill passed out of their other house, 92-49. So we're moving in the right direction there. You know, I look at this, and one of the things that I had called for, Jake, right from the beginning was we need to have a system where everybody's involved. There are no free riders. There's no opportunity for me to say, you know what, I just choose not to have health care. And if I get sick, I can just go to the hospital and let somebody else pay the bill. We've got to stop that. So what this is going to do is it's going to open up. It's going to be the first state to start this exchange process. It may lead down the road. I've seen reports that had they passed this, and we're going to see if they were to pass this, that 200 doctors were going to be moving into the area to take advantage of not having to worry about all of the insurance claims. I mean, think about it from a doctor's perspective. And I know a couple of doctors who say, you know, I wish I could get away from the whole billing thing. I wish I could just run my practice. You know, I wish I could just treat people. You know, some of my friends say, I didn't get into this to be a collection agent. I didn't get into this to fight with insurance companies. I didn't get into this to do all that goes on. So again, I think Vermont has done a great thing. It will be interesting to see how this moves forward. They're going to call it the Green Mountain Care Health Insurance Program, and they've set up this idea that you're going to be able to see a bunch of policies right there and be able to compare right there.
And what those who oppose health care, Rick, are really, really unfair. They act like this health care reform is just rigid federal mandates. It's a form of socialism. Well, what they don't understand or don't want to understand is the law gives each state flexibility. You can set up your own. You can set up an exchange in cooperation with another state, or you can simply do nothing and allow the federal government to come in and set one up for you. There's a lot of flexibility there. It's not one health care policy fits all. There's a lot of flexibility, and it will, in the end, allow each state to set up their own given the conditions in that state. I mean, that in a lot of ways is the free market. But yet those who oppose it say, oh, we don't want this. It's going to cost too much. It's socialism. Well, that's nonsense.
Well, you know, a good way of getting the costs, bringing the costs down, I look at New York State legislator. She is sponsoring this bill that I find quite interesting. You're going to limit the CEO salaries of hospitals taking state money to $250,000 a year. Because according to Crain's New York Business Report, last March, New York's top 21 hospital executives averaged well over $3 million a year. Topping the Crain's list was Dr. Herbert Paradis. He's the president and CEO of New York Presbyterian Hospital. Almost $10 million in 2008. Almost $10 million he put into his pocket, including $6.8 million in retirement benefits. So, you know, again, you want to talk about golden parachutes? You want to talk about Cadillac plans? Almost $7 million in retirement plans. New York's State Health Department currently has absolutely no authority, according to one of their spokesmen. He said to set compensation rate for private businesses, even if taxpayers' funding is a major revenue stream, is not possible. They don't have the authority just yet. So Assemblywoman Glick sees plenty of precedent for capping hospital executive compensation. What I find interesting is she's kind of using the right's key talking point against them, because evidently in New York they have capped pain and suffering for medical malpractice victims. So if you're going to cap, you're going to cap these folks' compensation for, you know, being harmed, shouldn't you be able to cap these guys taking from the top? I guess if it works, it's good for the goose, it's good for the gander.
Well, they've been pushing that for years in this state. It's the panacea, according to the right, for all the ills of the health care.
I'll tell you, I will thwart medical malpractice tort reform, the pain and suffering reform. I will support that if we change the way insurance companies who provide medical malpractice, if we change that to be based on claims paid out only. If I'm okay with capping people's compensation if the insurance companies sacrifice as well. Whatever they pay out in medical malpractice claims, they can charge in premiums. They can't go gambling in Wall Street. They can't invest in some failed ventures. They can't do all the things they're doing and then write that off and charge premiums for that. I'm sorry. It's got to be claims only. I tell you, I think if you did that, I think you would see medical malpractice come down mighty quick. But good for Vermont. You know, the governor there has said that he wants this single-payer system. You know, again, 9249, they are going to create a single-payer system in the state. I think that is great. It's a move in the right direction. And look, Vermont now is the first state in the country where health care is a right and not a privilege. You know, I've always been amazed at this notion that somehow you have the right to see an attorney when you get arrested. When you get into trouble, you've got the right to remain silent and have an attorney present. But you don't have to have the right to see a doctor when you get sick or when your kids get sick. To me, that just, it's absolutely mind-blowing. And, you know, when I see the Republicans, what all they're doing, we want to repeal and replace with the good old stuff, the way it used to be, where we can kick people off their policy, we can cap their benefits. You know, the good things we can deny them. You know, the good stuff that they were in favor for of before. I want to go back to that. You know, all this divisiveness. Where's the jobs? You know, I'm going to steal John Boehner's thunder. Where are the jobs, Mr. Boehner? Like he said to the president for the last year. Anyway, when we come back, we're going to talk about the jobs. Where are the jobs? How do we create jobs? Maybe give the right some advice. Also talk a little bit about coming together and moving forward as one. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, our good friend Isaiah Poole from the Campaign for America's Future, back after this.
Yes, it is. is all about the children, even after they're born. Rick Smith.
Workers Independent News. I'm Cunningham. Workers, unions, and their community allies are rallying in Los Angeles Saturday for jobs and community as they express solidarity with Wisconsin and other worker struggles around the country. Teamsters President James Hoffa.
What we're seeing here is the biggest attack on organized labor and the middle class that we've seen in the past 20 years. This is basically the right wing, the far right wing, the Tea Party. They've taken over six governorships, and they are attacking labor across the board. We are fighting back, and here in Los Angeles, this Saturday, we're going to have a march of over 15,000 people to talk about that we're not going backwards, we're not giving up our union rights, we're not going to give up our dreams for the middle class.
Hoffa says forging a long-term movement to take political power away from anti-union right-wingers is one goal of a re-energized workers' movement. And he says people are in a fight-back mood.
People who are under attack, the thousands of people that showed up in Madison, Wisconsin, the thousands of people that are showing up across the country with these demonstrations, the thousands of people are going to show up here in Los Angeles to basically say, hey, we're mad as hell. We're going to fight back. We're not going to let you take away our lives, our dreams.
The Los Angeles Labor Rally this weekend will help build a national day of labor action April 4th, the anniversary of the 1968 assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. as he stood in solidarity with public workers in Memphis.
The Associated Press has analyzed numbers in the land of Lincoln and learned that nearly 97% of state workers have union representation. Out of 50,000 state workers, that leaves roughly 1,700 not in a union. According to AP, in the last 8 years alone, Illinois has seen a four-fold increase in union representation. Illinois Governor Pat Quinn has denounced Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker's anti-labor legislation, but at the same time, he's been seeking support from the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees to allow thousands of workers to fall outside of the union's scope. The concern is that the situation leaves very few managers. The AP says the surge in the scope of employees joining unions, including non-traditional union-represented positions, such as prison wardens and chiefs of staff, was due to the administration of Rod Blagojevich, who had a poor relationship with state employees. It led to a need for unions to step in and provide the voice for employees that the eventually ousted governor was ignoring. If Quinn can't reach a compromise with AFSCME, legislation could be introduced that would remove the collective bargaining rights of employees that were allowed to join unions since the start of 2009.
This newscast made possible in part through underwriting from the AFL-CIO and by the National Association of Letter Carriers. You've been listening to WIND, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Every morning at the mine, you could see him arrive. He stood 6'6" and weighed 245, kind of broad at the shoulder and narrow at the hip. And everybody knew you didn't give no lip to Big John.
Yeah, that's the working class Big John. Then you've got the political, well, smaller John, the one that cries a lot. Our friend John Boehner. Where are the jobs? Where are the jobs? Like we were saying, where are the jobs, John? It's amazing to me that the right, who was so worked up, all a tizzy, that they've just kind of gone away and not held their people accountable. Amazing, amazing stuff. But we're going to talk about the jobs. How do we create it? How do we create an economy that works for everyone, not just the big corporate executives, not the healthcare CEOs in New York making over $3 million a year? How do we do that? That's why I've asked Isaiah Poole from the Campaign for America's Future, ourfuture.org, to come talk to us a bit. Isaiah, thanks for taking time for us.
My pleasure.
So what's going on?
Well, as you said, while the poll after poll after poll has been saying that jobs are the number one issue that the American public is interested in Congress focusing on. We had a presentation at our job summit a couple of weeks ago from Celinda Lake, and she showed us polling that showed that there's about a 15-point difference between people's support for job creation first as opposed to deficit reduction. there's a CBS News poll that came out this week where that gap is even wider. 63% or in that poll said, we want Congress focused on job creation first and deficit reduction later. But all of the action while Congress has been out of session this week has been on cobbling together deals on cutting Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, and on cutting deals to cut social programs, and cutting deals to cut job training, and cutting deals to cut aid to the states. So the priorities of Congress are still very much out of whack with what the American people are demanding. I think in this case, the American people are being very smart. You cannot have real deficit reduction while unemployment rates are going to be running 9% for the next year or two.
Right. You know, what bothers me is, one, that Congress did take a recess, and I wish I had a gig where I could, you know, work a week or two and take a week off, work a week or two, take a week off. But that seems to be the way things are set up there, especially when we don't really even have a budget. They've been doing these short-term budgets. They should be at work every day, but yet, again, you know, you look at what the Republicans have done. I don't know that there's much in the way of job creation. Well, let me ask you, you compared job creation to deficit reduction, and we know there's a huge gulf between them. Is there any polling on the American people saying, I want Republicans working on job creation or on taking rights away from women by limiting abortions, or taking rights away from workers, limiting collective bargaining rights? Are you seeing any polling on that?
I am not seeing any polling. In fact, Scott Walker's popularity in Wisconsin has fallen like a rock. I think his favorability is in the low 30s right now. And if you look at some of the other states where Republican governors have pushed this anti-worker agenda, none of those governors are getting a lot of popular support for that focus.
I got to be honest, because part of me thought when the Republicans took control that, you know, to kind of reinforce that positive for the radical right, that, you know, the public, you know, the corporate sector, they would say, okay, we're gonna create a couple of jobs just to make the Republicans look good. That really hasn't happened, and the Republicans haven't seemed to be interested in getting out there and actually doing things that create jobs. Everything I'm seeing them do seems to be costing us jobs. We want to repeal the healthcare bill. They claim it's going to cost us 700,000 jobs to do that. To me, that doesn't seem logical.
It's not logical. But what we're not talking about logic here. Keep in mind that you have a number of Tea Party candidates who ran quite loudly on this platform of making dramatic cuts in the federal budget. These are ideologues who are now basically controlling the agenda. I mean, they're controlling John Boehner. I think Boehner would rather be sort of the typical Republican leader, you know, go in, make a lot of noise, but then cut a deal to keep things moving.
Right.
Some of the more radical Republicans won't let him do that.
Yeah, I got to be honest. I don't know that I would want to be John Boehner, because he is really, he's in a really tough spot, because he has a very large radical wing that will run off on its own and pretty much tank the entire party.
Well, exactly right. Now, the other side of the ledger, though, is a Democratic Party, which I still don't think has found its voice yet on this issue. There are some signs that that's beginning to happen over in the Senate. For example, Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid drew a line in the sand on Social Security. He said it doesn't have anything to do with deficit. It shouldn't be part of deficit discussion. We have more important things to talk about right now. And he drew that line in the sand. And he drew a line in the sand that actually over the bodies of some of the people in his own Democratic caucus.
Well, here's the thing. At some point, you know, I keep saying I'm waiting for the Democratic Tom DeLay to come around. Because say what you want about DeLay, he did keep his folks on path towards where they were heading.
That's true. And you know, there was a method, there was an ideology, there was a set of, you know, people. I mean, even now, people know what the Republican brand represents.
Yep.
They know pretty much what the Republican agenda is. I think we're still at a point where people don't exactly know what the Democrats are up to. What they do know is that President Obama, as likable as he is, has stumbled on this jobs issue. However well-intentioned the Democrats in Congress may be, they have not projected a clear message to the public that the public can rally behind. So there's a lot of work to be done, both on the White House and on Pennsylvania Avenue.
Yeah, and I say the way that work gets accomplished is not expect them to be leaders, but to be the people who do what we push them into doing,
this is the formula that actually the Tea Party grassroots caught on to.
Right.
And the reason why Democrats lost the House was not because, well, certainly there were people at the top. There were Dick Armey and the Koch brothers and all of those guys who were throwing money at this movement. But the movement wasn't Koch brothers. The movement wasn't DeLay. The movement was a bunch of folk with hand-drawn signs and demeaning pictures of President Obama and stuff like this, who were just sort of outraged and frustrated, and in their anger and frustration, lashed out at the Democrats.
I got to be honest, though. At the very beginning, you know, I could have been a teabag. I could have been a tea partier. I was angry, I was frustrated, and I've gone through this before. It's when they took that bizarre right turn towards corporations will save us, and we're gonna side with the Koch brothers, because very early, you're right, that's what happened, that's what began it, but it was that money, that influx of Republican elite influence that really kind of pushed it to the next level, got it onto Fox News every time anyone had a sign. That's what I think propelled it to what it was.
Right. So I think now what we've got to do is really have a very sharply honed message that really strikes back at the fallacies of what the right has been saying, and what some of the corporate mouthpieces on the right has been saying. I mean, that's why I was really interested. If you look at our site, I wrote a piece about a speech Eric Cantor made this week, which was supposed to have been his Jobs speech. So he went down to the Hoover Institute and did this. This was going to be his big Jobs agenda presentation. And it was startling to me that it really was the same old talking point that the Republicans have been using for the last 20 years. But not only that, the talking points, not that they weren't, it wasn't even talking points that were sort of ideologically debatable. There were facts that were simply wrong.
Right.
You know, the notion that corporations are saddled by this 35% tax rate, when in fact there's a big article in the New York Times today that talks about how General Electric, one of our largest corporations, pays no taxes at all. In fact, we give General Electric money.
Yep.
There's money that comes out of the taxpayer's pockets that goes into GE's bottom line because of the way that they manipulate the tax code. And, oh, by the way, they're still not creating jobs.
Well, they are creating jobs. The article went into it quite explicitly. They're creating jobs in China.
Well, there you go. They're certainly not creating them in the United States.
Well, yeah, but, you know, again, you know, they're creating jobs, just not here. I think we need to have that emphasis on here.
Yes. That's exactly right. So, but, you know, I think what we need to do is start reminding people that whenever Republicans say things like the reason we don't have jobs is that because corporations are overtaxed, we have to come back and say, no, the truth of the matter is that corporations aren't really paying their fair share in taxes, and they haven't been paying their fair share of taxes for years. And we're not going to let them get away with that anymore. We're not going to let them use that as an excuse. And just keep those arguments out there.
Right. And when a Republican says tax cuts create jobs, ask when.
And ask when. Exactly right. I mean, we've done this now since the 1980s. And in fact, you know, one of the things about the New York Times article that struck me was that even Ronald Reagan back in the late 80s, when he looked at how GE was manipulating the tax code to try to get out from underpaying taxes, even he was upset.
Yeah, well, this is what happens when you allow a corporation to get that large, when you allow them to be as big as a behemoth like GE is.
Yeah.
Because they have the resources to hire an army of tax lawyers and former Treasury Department secretaries and former IRS secretaries and all of these big brains who know how to negotiate the system. That's what happens when you have the resources.
Well, exactly right. On the other hand, you or I, you know, we don't have former Treasury secretaries or former IRS executives that we can go to figure out how to get out, how to lower our tax bills.
Nope. And so just like here in Pennsylvania, I can't open a P.O. box in Delaware and use the Delaware loophole to not pay Pennsylvania tax.
Well, maybe if you turned your show into a subchapter S corporation, maybe you could pull something.
We don't make that much profit. But here's the thing. I know there are a bunch of rallies coming along. This idea that we must come together, we must become one. And the frame I've been using, you know, we're all in the shark tank, man. Just the flavor of the month, the shark is hungry for public sector workers. But eventually we're all in the tank and that shark's going to get hungry for each one of us at one time or another. Where do you see this going?
Well, I hope that and you're referring to the April 4th mobilizations that will be taking place all over the country. And what I hope will happen is that people will see that we are in a common struggle. All of us who are either in the middle class or struggling to get into the middle class. And it's not public workers versus private workers. It's not black workers versus white workers. It's we are all under assault due to a set of plutocratic policies that have been enacted by a government that's run amok. And what we need to do is say, as we the people, we need to say, wait a minute, this government and this country needs to work for the common man. This economy must work for the common man, not just for corporations, not just for billionaires, but it has to work for the guy who's making $50,000 a year, who's trying to support a wife and a kid.
Yeah, I'm right there with you, and it has to work for the guy who's making, you know, $15,000 or $18,000 a year. Those are the people
right.
We should be lifting up, which
right.
is the reason we need stronger collective bargaining rules, not weaker.
That exactly right. The significance. I know you're going to be talking about the shirtwaist fire back in 1911, and I'm glad you're doing that because that is the reminder of what happened. When you disempower workers, you give all of the power to the corporation, and the corporation is allowed to do whatever it wants and essentially treat their employees as worse than slaves.
You know, locking them in the building.
Locking them in the building. And if you think, I've often hear people on the right say that, well, you know, if you don't like those working conditions, you can get up and get another job. Well, let me tell you something. When you've got 4.5 or 5 people applying for every job position, in other words, and that's sort of the ratio that we have of unemployed people versus jobs to be done, jobs that are available, you know, you can't up and go from one employer to another.
Yeah, I'm
plus
right there with
we
it.
We have, you know, the issue of so many of our benefits are still tied to jobs, health care, and so on.
Well, I've said for the longest time, in this country, without a job, you die. You know, because once you lose your job, very shortly after that, you lose your health care, and heaven forbid you get sick.
Yeah.
Which is why I'm glad to see the folks of Vermont have passed the very first single-payer health care plan for their citizens up there. I'm hoping that will catch fire and move across the country.
Yeah, that's one of the things we really ought to pay attention to, what they're doing in Vermont. It is the good news in what has otherwise been a very bad year, I think, for health care reform, with the House doing what is pledging to sort of throw every sort of monkey wrench into health care reform.
Well, it is the drumbeat. But as we move forward, it's going to take folks like you, groups like the Campaign for America's Future, to be out there pushing the good news. I appreciate the work you guys do over the Campaign for America's Future, ourfuture.org. Isaiah, always great talking to you. Thanks so much, brother.
So much. So good talking to you as well.
All righty. We're going to take a quick break. Right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425.
Working, as long as my two hands are fit to use, I'll drink my beer in a tavern, sing a little bit of these working men.
Proudly blue in an ocean of red, Rick Smith.
Much of the success of American law enforcement can be traced to this important reality. Criminals tend to be stupid. In other words, they catch themselves. On the other hand, much of the failure of American law enforcement can be traced to another important reality. Our criminal laws tend to be stupider than our criminals. Take the Combat Meth Act of 2004. It prompted various states to set up electronic systems for limiting and tracking the sales of pseudoephedrine, the widely used cold medicine. These pills are good for easing the dripping and sniffling that come with colds and allergies. But pseudoephedrine is also good for making something bad. Methamphetamine, the savagely addictive drug that is a scourge of communities across the country, especially in rural areas. Thus, banning over-the-counter sales of pseudoephedrine and rationing the amount each customer can buy was well-intentioned. But restricting its sale has created a very lucrative black market for the pills, luring thousands of new peddlers, hustlers, and opportunists into the illicit meth underworld. Meth brokers and producers recruit legions of friends, homeless people, college kids eager for quick cash, and even their own children to go pharmacy to pharmacy, with each smurfer, as they are called, buying the limit on pills. Using store specials and even clipping coupons, they can buy a box of pseudoephedrine for $8, then sell the pills to meth producers for $50. That's a nice profit for 30 minutes or so of their time. This is Jim Hightower saying, so while this drug war on cold pills has added inconvenience to legitimate customers and expense to pharmacies, it has failed to curb the meth trade and has created a booming new network of black market criminals for the police to chase. Can we now admit that this is stupid and try something else?
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at HightowerLowdown.com.
Bringing sanity and rational thought back to America. Rick Smith.
Yes, go on, take the money and run. Yes, yes, yes. Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at therickSmithShow.com, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Our quote of the day comes from Bob King, president of the United Auto Workers, commenting on the $56.6 million stock grant award that Ford Motor Company's chief executive took. $56.6 million in stock for their chief executive. He says, quote, I think Adam Mulally is a great CEO, but I don't think any human being in the world deserves that much money. And I agree. You know, you look at this, and I'm sorry. I'm sorry. You know, when you've got people on the assembly line, I understand the UAW gave massive, enormously large concessions, especially for younger workers. They agreed to that bizarre, like some folks have done, this two-tier system where the younger workers coming in are actually making $14 an hour in some of their plants. And you've got this guy taking almost $57 million? Really? One guy did this. One guy turned the whole company around single-handedly. He was the guy who swept the floor, did all the assembly, did all the sales, did all the transportation, did everything else. Did it all himself. I'm just absolutely amazing at how we reward those at the very top with unlimited riches. And yet the people at the bottom, we seem to want to steal from. And you go to Wisconsin and you look at the law that they just passed stealing collective bargaining rights away. A court said you cannot publish that law. Told the Secretary of State. Can't do it. So what did they do? They published the law through the Legislative Reference Bureau. The action was announced on their webpage today. Now, I don't know if it's going to be law or not. The governor is saying, you know what, we're going to enforce it as if it's law because it's been published, even though the judge said, you don't do it. Don't publish that law. Don't publish that. And they turned around and did it anyway. Why? Because they think they're above the law. They think that they're better than the things that you and I have to follow. So why is it that we look to the CEOs and the top executives and say, oh, yeah, they're well worth the multi-millions they get? That healthcare executive who in New York is making over $3 million a year, somehow he's worth more than that nurse who's working a 16-hour shift making sure that people's lives are taken care of. Somehow he's worth it, she's not. We're going to take her rights away but enforce his contract. What sense does that make? And you look at what happened in New Hampshire this week, another state that has lost its ever-loving freaking mind. Tuesday night, Republicans passed Scott Walker's bill, basically, only worse. Not only did they strip collective bargaining rights from public sector workers, they've made it that public sector workers in the state are now at will. These are at-will employees now. They have no rights. They can come to work tomorrow and say, you know what? Hey, have a nice day. You're out the door. Just like people in Pennsylvania have the right, unless you have a contract. But remember, the CEO, they got their contracts, which is why he got $57 million, 56.6. I mean, that's obscene to me. Yet these workers who take care of our parents, take care of our grandparents, take care of our children, for some reason, they're not worth having a contract. They're not worth a reasonable standard of living. I mean, I'm amazed at this. And yesterday there was a big rally. The unions are out there saying, hey, you can't steal collective bargaining rights away. It's bad. It's bad for the state. Really upset about the at-will thing. I mean, well, there's a Democratic governor there in New Hampshire. We'll see where this goes. But still, at the end of all this, Jake, it's absolutely insane to me that we're seeing this kind of attack all over the country by these radical right-wingers.
Well, the situation you described in Wisconsin, it sounds like the governor very well might be in contempt of court.
Well, I hope so.
And I would just love to see him arrested.
He would be very loved in prison. Very loved in prison. Remember yesterday we talked about the Maine governor, another attack on workers, Paul LePage. He's the guy who said when he was a kid he used to hide in the alley and beat up the little kids and steal their Halloween candy, and now he's governor. Well, anyway, a group called Maine People's Voting Coalition, they've hired an attorney, and they're claiming that the governor's taking down, stripping the history of the state's labor from the Department of Labor building, this 36-foot mural, it's illegal. So this is going to go to court. Hopefully they're going to hold this off. Again, you know, this is one of those really, really stupid but symbolic things. It's going to cost the state of Maine a boatload of money, not only to litigate, but to also do. And what it really is a slap in the face to every working person in that state. It's amazing to me. I'm going to take a quick break. Right back after this, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425.
In an ocean of red, Rick Smith.
Do you need a sign or promotional material for your business, campaign, or function? Then All Union Signs and Promos is the place for you. For years, All Union Signs and Promos has been serving South Central Pennsylvania with affordable, high-quality, union-made and American-made signs and promotional products. We want you to be seen. We set ourselves apart not only by being your one-stop, full-service sign shop, but also being able to tie that image into a full line of promotional products. Our dedicated staff will print, design, and deliver your most effective advertising tool on time and on budget. If you have a message, we have a sign. When you need your name on it, All Union Signs and Promos will do it with a memorable and unique union-made and American-made product. For more information about union-made and American-made products, visit our website at allunionsigns.com. That's allunionsigns.com. Or give us a call at 717-221-8888.
Chances are, when you took a shower this morning, an AFSCME member made sure that water was clean. When you drove to work, an AFSCME member maintained the road. When you rode an elevator, an AFSCME member inspected it. I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. The work isn't glamorous, the salaries aren't high, but AFSCME members serve the public in every aspect of our daily lives. Chances are, you'll never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org. We are AFSCME.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
And going back to this thing about this mural, this to me is of huge import, only because it's very symbolic. It's like it's that shot across the boardroom, if you will, that tells the CEOs of the country that, you know what, Maine is your best friend, and bring your exploitative work here, bring the robber baron of old back to Maine. The reality is, and they have to know that it's illegal, because a section of the law in the state says the Maine State Museum holds title as trustee for the state to all historical materials and other than documents and other library or archival items under the administrative jurisdiction of the Maine State Library or the Maine State Archives that are or may become the property of the state, or are or may be housed in the public buildings of the state, including the banners and flags presented, presently housed in the state's Hall of Flags, and may include, but are not limited or restricted to, paintings, sculptures, or other works of art dealing with historic subjects. So I think it's pretty clear that this mural deals with the history of labor, the history of workers. But again, you know, it's that slap in the face. It's that we're going to do it my way or the highway. And that's what bothers me. You've got these dictatorial figures who, with their tyrannical fists, have overreached so blatantly that I don't even know that the Tea Party realizes it's happening. And they're the ones who put these folks into power. Good for you. So during the interview with Isaiah Poole, he mentioned the GE story, which I thought was, you know, I think is of massive importance. They are the largest corporation in the country. And they had a really good year, according to the New York Times, in 2010. They reported worldwide profits around $12.2 billion. And somehow magically they divvied that up and said, well, a little over $5 billion of it came from the operations here in the U.S. So, okay, we'll tax that $5 billion at 35%, right? Wrong. What they paid in U.S. taxes last year, its American tax bill was nothing. In fact, GE claimed a tax benefit of $3.2 billion. So they had taken money back. The Times reports that may be hard to fathom for the millions of American business owners and households now preparing their own returns, but low taxes are nothing new for GE. The company has been cutting the percentage of its American profits paid to the Internal Revenue Service for years, resulting in a far lower rate than most corporations, according to MSNBC.com. Now, how'd they do this? How did they get to the point to where they can slice a little bit off here, claim this, claim a whole bunch of tax credits, claim a whole bunch of incentives, and actually shape law? Well, big lobbyists, lots of lobby money, lots of lobbying for tax breaks and innovative accounting. Now remember that their slogan is, Jake, it's imagination at work. And imagination is something they do quite well, especially when it comes to using the IRS tax code, because what they've done is they have this massive department. This massive department of former Treasury officials, former IRS officials, and virtually all the tax writing committees in Congress they've got a representative from. So these are the folks who know how to navigate every single loophole. So when people say, just like here in Pennsylvania has the highest tax rate in the country, they say the United States has the highest tax rate in the world. It doesn't seem to me that folks like GE are paying it. In fact, we're paying them. So what I find interesting is we keep hearing this, we need to be more business friendly. Everyone keeps saying we need to be more business friendly because we want to encourage businesses. Now you look at GE. GE has not created jobs in this country. In fact, they've closed a number of plants. What was it, 26 since Obama has taken office? That to me does not sound like someone who is creating jobs in this country, which is why I find it bizarre that President Obama has made Jeffrey Immelt, the CEO of GE, his job czar. And if you look at the reality, all of the tax breaks that this company has gotten in their since this financial crisis happened, since all of this meltdown happened, GE has posted a loss in the U.S. Their regulatory filings show that they've accumulated some $26 billion in profit. And we have paid them $4.1 billion in taxes. So somehow, a very profitable company, $26 billion in profit during this whole crisis, and we're handing them more. Is that good for us? I mean, I go back to what George Bush said when he said, you know, with a robust package of $550 million, we're going to create a million new jobs. Is it worth $550,000 a job? Or in this case, we're losing jobs. Is it worth the $4.1 billion to hand over? And I don't have the answer. I think it's common sense. We shouldn't be handing out this money, but what are your thoughts?
Well, I'm going to say something that's directed at this situation. It's a little bit of a different angle. You have some conservatives that have been pushing a flat tax. Some call it a fair tax and say, well, you got to eliminate all deductions for business and individuals. That would last probably about a month.
Do they say business?
Some of them do.
Okay, because
some of them do.
I've never heard that
one. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Okay. Some of them do, and the problem is you have these powerful corporations, and they have batteries of lawyers, and they have these, they've contributed for years to the political system. They have connections. I mean, they're going to push for the tax breaks, which benefit them and their company. That's the reason a fair tax and a flat tax would never work, because you, within our system, the way it's structured now with the influence of money, that just wouldn't hold water. I mean, you could pass a law that says no deductions, and I guarantee you within a short time that'll change.
Well, that's what they claim the tax reform bill of 86 was, closing some of the loopholes. And there were some loopholes that closed, but over time, all of the things that they took from us, they eventually gave back to the big corporations. Now, understand, why does that happen? Well, GE spends money on lobbying. In fact, they've spent more than $200 million in the last decade. $200 million. They're not going to invest $200 million into lobbying if they're not going to get something back from it. And you look at the Bush era, the American Job Creation Act. Remember that? It contained about $13 billion a year in tax breaks for corporations. Most of them benefited GE. You look at it, you go, I'm sorry. Did the GE lobbyists write it? Part of it they actually did. So when I look at all this, I got to ask the question. You look since 2002, the company's gotten rid of 20% of its workforce here in the U.S. and moved those jobs somewhere else. They take their profits with them. In the time that they've offshored, profits have risen to $92 billion from $15 billion. Are they that much more productive? Are they selling that much more product? No. What they've done is they've walked away from their labor costs. They've walked away from their local taxes, their federal taxes. That's all money. Between $92 billion in the profit that they got and the $15 billion that they used to make, that is money that used to go into the government coffers that are now going into the hands of large investors and the ultra wealthy. You want to talk about redistribution of wealth? Let's talk about redistribution of wealth. This is it. Plain and in a nutshell. And I say at some point, there's part of me that goes, you know what? Maybe we just stop taxing corporations altogether and have a massive consumption tax. Maybe we go to a pure income tax where everything's charged as income. Because what seems to happen is the wealthy always figure out or lobby for ways to enrich themselves at our expense. And that's what's frustrating about all this stuff. Look, people go to work, they bust their behinds, they work hard, they try and get ahead, and they're constantly pushed back by the folks who sit on their yachts collecting dividend checks, drinking martinis.
Well, I guess my question is, Rick, are you going to put a consumption tax on everything?
Well,
you're going to put it on basic staples?
Well, at some point, you got to look at ways of doing this. And I'm just throwing out an idea. I'm going to take a quick break. Right back after this with Pennsylvania State Representative Mike Sterla. Back after this.
Smith Show, changing America for the better.
The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
Workers Independent News, I'm Doug Cunningham.
Workers, unions, and their community allies are rallying in Los Angeles Saturday for jobs and community as they express solidarity with Wisconsin and other worker struggles around the country. Teamsters President James Hoffa.
What we're seeing here is the biggest attack on organized labor and the middle class that we've seen in the past 20 years. This is basically the right wing, the far right wing, the Tea Party. They've taken over six governorships, and they are attacking labor across the board. We are fighting back, and here in Los Angeles, this Saturday, we're going to have a march of over 15,000 people to talk about that we're not going backwards, we're not giving up our union rights, we're not going to give up our dreams for the middle class.
Hoffa says forging a long-term movement to take political power away from anti-union right-wingers is one goal of a re-energized workers' movement. And he says people are in a fight-back mood.
People who are under attack, all the thousands of people that showed up in Madison, Wisconsin, the thousands of people that are showing up across the country with demonstrations, the thousands of people are going to show up here in Los Angeles to basically say, hey, we're mad as hell. We're going to fight back. We're not going to let you take away our lives, our dreams.
The Los Angeles Labor Rally this weekend will help build a national day of labor action April 4th, the anniversary of the 1968 assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. as he stood in solidarity with public workers in Memphis.
The Associated Press has analyzed numbers in the land of Lincoln and learned that nearly 97% of state workers have union representation. Out of 50,000 state workers, that leaves roughly 1,700 not in a union. According to AP, in the last 8 years alone, Illinois has seen a four-fold increase in union representation. Illinois Governor Pat Quinn has denounced Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker's anti-labor legislation. But at the same time, he's been seeking support from the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees to allow thousands of workers to fall outside of the union's scope. The concern is that the situation leaves very few managers. The AP says the surge in the scope of employees joining unions, including non-traditional union-represented positions, such as prison wardens and chiefs of staff, was due to the administration of Rod Blagojevich, who had a poor relationship with state employees. It led to a need for unions to step in and provide the voice for employees that the eventually ousted governor was ignoring. If Quinn can't reach a compromise with AFSCME, legislation could be introduced that would remove the collective bargaining rights of employees that were allowed to join unions since the start of 2009.
This newscast made possible in part through underwriting from the AFL-CIO and by the National Association of Letter Carriers. You've been listening to WIN, Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Bringing sanity and rational thought back to America. Rick Smith.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. You know, what we're seeing across this country, 37 states going after workers in one fashion or another, Wisconsin taking the rights of collective bargaining away from their public sector employees, as we find out, New Hampshire wanting to make the state an at-will state, like right here in Pennsylvania. At some point, these attacks have got to be stopped and met head on. That's why when I saw House Resolution 134 here in the state of Pennsylvania, that recognizes the rights of workers to form a union and collectively bargain with employers, it also calls for an end to the war on workers. I said, you know what? This is good stuff. I support this wholeheartedly, and good for them. And I'm drumming up support. That's why I've asked Pennsylvania State Representative Mike Sterler to come on the program and talk with us a bit about this and the direction of the state. Representative, thanks for taking time for us.
Sure. Thanks for having me on.
You know, I look at what's going on across the country, and a lot of folks are saying, well, we're not seeing that here. I'm saying that we may be seeing some of this very soon.
Well, I think we saw a little bit of it in the governor's budget address. He said he's going to eliminate 1,500 jobs. You know, in one sentence or one paragraph, he says this budget is about creating jobs. In the next paragraph, he says, oh, by the way, I'm going to lay off 1,500 state employees. And that's in a state that has the lowest number of state employees per capita of any state in the nation.
You know, what is it? I mean, I guess the question I have is, what is it that, that the right has against anything public, anything that, that is the commons that we the people hold? Because all across the country, I'm seeing this radicalization of the Republican Party that wants to sell off everything that we hold, that want to privatize every function that we do. I'm really struggling with that.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think they've lost sight of the notion of we the people, that our government really is we the people. It is, government is about the things that we do collective, if you will. I mean, you know, it would be hard for me as an individual citizen to go build a road, but as a government, together with my neighbors, I can get a road built. It would be hard for me to police my neighborhood by myself, but collectively, with my neighbors, we can hire a policeman. It would be hard for me to educate all my children by myself, but collectively we can pay professors and teachers and have a school system that does that. And I think, you know, for some Republicans, that whole notion flies in the face of the fact that somebody didn't make a buck off the deal.
I got to be honest, I understand that perspective if I were David Koch or if I were a billionaire, because I could do all those things. But as you point out, I can't. And I, you know, I got to get to work. I got to educate my kids. There's all these things we have to do that I depend on society for.
Yeah, well, and I think that in that sense, Republicans have been very good about convincing the public about things that they aren't. You know, when you ask a group of people who here is in favor of the death tax, you barely get a hand up. You know, and first off, they called it the death tax instead of an inheritance tax. And then you say, and how many of you are millionaires? And no one puts their hand up again. And you say, so you would never pay that tax. And they go, oh, really? That's not what I thought. I thought somebody was going to come in and take my home, you know? It's just there's a lot of misinformation out there. And I think they've been very good about putting that misinformation out there. I don't agree with putting this information out, but I think that's part of their MO.
Well, I think that's the difference between the right and left, if you will, between the radical Republicans, and there are some good Republicans. I don't want to bash all of them, but the radical ones, they're very good at campaigning. They're very good at sloganeering. I think, like you said, death tax is pure brilliance in linguistics and imaging and all of that. They seem to be better at that than you guys on the Democratic side. They seem to be better at running for office, running campaigning. But it seems to me that Democrats generally are better at governing.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, I think they're better at misleading. And that's not something that I'm necessarily interested in. You know, I think that the thing that we do have going for us as progressives is that, you know, the saying in the back of the house that's on the ceiling is, the truth will set you free. And ultimately, I think if we stick to the truth, and make sure that the information gets out there, I have faith that the public, you know, will come down on the side of doing the right thing if they know what the true information is.
Yeah, see, that's the key right there. The truth will set you free if you can get it out.
Yeah, yeah.
So maybe we should amend that. Go through an amendment process. Get that put up there. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're here with Pennsylvania State Representative Mike Sturley. You know, this week there was a hearing on prevailing wage. And again, another one of these attacks on workers' rights. And, you know, this notion that Matt Brulé over here at the Tinky Tank saying, well, you know, prevailing wage is racist, to me just really is, as you've pointed out, misinformation, but really disingenuous.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, it's the notion that on a project that the public is paying for, that we should somehow be willing to say it's okay if that person makes minimum wage or less than minimum wage or a non-family sustaining wage, because then they can go fend for themselves, because I wouldn't give them any sort of public assistance either, because, you know, if I'm one of those guys that's against the prevailing wage, I'm against public assistance, I'm against all those other things. The notion that as a society we would try and place someone in that situation purposefully, I think it's just immoral.
No, I absolutely agree. But here's my you know, here's kind of the thing that I've got going on here. You know, you look at again, the misinformation, but as we talk about stealing collective bargaining rights away from public sector workers, we talk about, you know, stealing away prevailing wage laws that help protect the public from cronyism. I see us moving backwards to where we're talking about patronage at really enormous levels. The possibilities of going back to the days where with the political winds decided who got contracts and the political winds decided who got jobs, to me, I don't want that. I want a government that is effective, open, transparent, and more than anything, efficient and that works.
Yeah. Well, you know, and if you look at this current budget that's been proposed by Governor Corbett, you know, he's got what has now been termed the supreme decider. He wants his nominee for Secretary of Department of Community Economic Development, Alan Walker, who used to run the coal companies, to be able to suspend any rule or regulation in the state if he thinks it's getting in the way of jobs. You know, never in the history of this state have we given someone that much power. Not even the governor. The governor hasn't had that kind of power to suspend any rule or regulation just for the heck of it. And so when you talk about cronyism and, you know, here's somebody who I believe has contributed something around $185,000 to campaigns for this governor. And, you know, then you put somebody like that in control and say, you get to suspend the rules. You get to make up the rules that you want. I find that at the same time that you're saying we want a more open, transparent government, that kind of hypocrisy, if you will, is a little bit beyond the pale.
Yeah, I mean, to me, by stripping all these things away and stealing all these things away, we're going back to the good old to the good old days for them. Well, as you point out, this guy's going to now be able to dictate which rules and how his friends are going to benefit. It's to me a major step backwards. But you look at what you just said. This guy can now suspend any rules. You look at what Michigan's doing. They want to be able to appoint someone to come in and basically suspend all contracts, any rules. So when I see this stuff, and I'd love to hear your opinion on it, it looks to me that this is a centralized, concerted effort by all of these radicals to reform the entire country, not just one state at a time.
Yeah, and, you know, if you go back and look, I mean, this has been a central theme of, you know, those the powers that were trying to wrest the government back from the people for a long time. And I think that, you know, what we're seeing is just that. Last couple decades, we've seen the pay of CEOs become hugely disproportionate to their average workers as compared to what it used to be. We've seen more and more money concentrated in fewer and fewer people's pockets. We've seen government start to cater to those few people. And those people have basically bought government. And unless we get the citizens to understand what's happening to them, you know, somebody who's got a lot of money and convinces somebody that they ought to be rallying for some reason other than their own best interest, I think doesn't make a whole lot of sense. But they've been pretty successful at that. When you own certain media markets, when you own, you know, control over some of the messages that get out there, and you're that wealthy, you're seeing some of that happen now.
No, well, like I've read, 80% of everything we see, hear, and read it's controlled by six corporations.
Yeah.
I mean, it's scary stuff. But here's the thing, Representative, you know, you look at this, and at some point I say we have to begin to fight back. This budget that they've put out, to me, is very, very short-sighted, complete lack of leadership, lack of vision for where the country is going. A billion-dollar cut to education, a 54% cut to higher education. To me, again, if you want to be a state where businesses come, I don't know having a dumb workforce is the way to do it.
Well, no, when you talk to businesses, you know, top of their list is a highly educated workforce. You know, pretty far down on their list is the lowest taxes. Every business knows that they have a responsibility to pay a certain amount of taxes. Matter of fact, what I find interesting is when you talk to particularly the energy companies in this state, which have taken a whole lot of beating on the Marcellus Shale issue,
right.
They basically say to you, can't you guys figure out how to get us taxed so we don't keep getting a black eye? Because they're willing to pay that tax. What we have is a couple of ideologues at the top of this pyramid scheme here that are saying, no way, no how, not going to let it happen. And I think that if the public keeps the pressure on, I think those companies will pretty soon be out on the streets with them protesting, asking for a tax, because that kind of, ideology where you simply say, I'm going to make the facts try and fit my ideology. The reality is, we're the only state that doesn't have that, severance tax on the natural resources. The companies themselves say they're willing to pay it. We've got the local municipalities, particularly in those areas, clamoring for some relief because of the impact of this industry in their local area. And we've got a $4 billion deficit, and we're cutting education. That absolutely makes no sense.
Not at all. And the reality is, the point that I think everybody needs to know is we are already paying that tax. It's already in their business plan. Governor Corbett says that he wants to be like Texas. Well, Texas has a 7.5% drilling tax and some other very good law along with that.
Yeah. Well, that's the one interesting part when the governor said he wanted to be like Texas. So as you point out, they do have the drilling tax. They also have, when you get your property tax bill in Texas, there's two portions to it. One is the value of the land and buildings on it, and the other is the value of all the minerals underneath that. So they actually have a local tax on the value of the minerals, which we don't have in the state of Pennsylvania. On top of that, Texas has closed their Delaware loophole, so they aren't just allowing people to run off to Delaware and rent a mailbox and get themselves a way to avoid taxes in that state. Their sales tax is higher than ours. The one thing they don't have in Texas is a personal income tax,
right,
because they tax everything else. This governor said, no, citizens can pay that personal income tax. We just aren't going to tax business.
Right.
Sort of the reverse of what this does.
And, here's the thing. What I've been saying is I will give him a pass on the bizarre pledge thing. I'll give him a pass. As long as he does the right thing, all right, it was a campaign stunt, whatever. We'll forget it, move on, but just do the right thing.
Right. And I think that, that's where everybody but the governor is at this point in time. If you talk to members of the legislature on the Republican side, both in the House and the Senate, before the governor's budget proposal, they said, gee, we aren't sure how he's going to do this, but, let's more power to him if he can figure something out. And then his proposal came out, and they ran for the hills. The Republican appropriations chair in the House said he would not vote for this budget. You've got the Senate Republican appropriations chair who represents the Penn State area. I don't think he's going to cut Penn State 50%. So they've basically said, we got to find a different way to do this. My fear is that,
they're going to cut public welfare.
Yeah, that's where they're headed. They've intimated that, and, 70% of public welfare is senior citizens in nursing homes and persons with disabilities and in wheelchairs. And, the notion that we're going to go after those folks really kind of rankles me a little bit.
But going back to what we were talking about earlier in the messaging game, when you talk about public welfare, you think of Reagan's welfare queen driving around in the inner Cadillac collecting welfare checks.
Right.
That's the meme that they throw out there. Got about another minute left. On Monday there's a big rally. I don't know if you're aware of it. The APSCUF union, the professors union, a bunch of students are coming to town, to protest these budget cuts of higher education, 11:30 a.m. on the Capitol steps. Would like to invite you to come there and participate if you're in town.
Yeah, I haven't been, my schedule says I'm not there, but I have it on my schedule in case my schedule changes so that I can get there. The one thing I'll caution is I think, you've seen a little bit of, people saying, well, you shouldn't cut higher education, cause basic ed had gotten increases in the past, but basic ed cuts might be okay. I don't think we can afford either one of those. And I would caution people to point fingers at each other. The reality is what we need to do is add a few dollars to this pie And this governor has said he wouldn't do that. And I think we've got to get him to move a little bit as opposed to pitting our kindergarten kids against our college kids and our seniors in a nursing home against someone in a wheelchair and, you know, that kind of thing. Because that's the route that they're headed.
Well, and I hope that doesn't happen, because you're right. Education across the board is something that we need to invest in. Because I got to be honest, I'm 43. Eventually down the road, I'm going to need someone who's half intelligent to take care of me in my later years. So I think I'd like to have a qualified doctor or a qualified nurse take care of me when I need it. Pennsylvania State Representative Mike Sterla, I appreciate your time, brother. Look forward to talking to you again.
Okay.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. Right back with your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Radio of, for, and by, we the working people. The Rick Smith Show.
PSECU, we know those holiday bills can really pile up and hit you with double-digit interest rates or fees that start to snowball. Next thing you know, you're buried in a mountain of debt. Dig out by using our 3.9 annual percentage rate Visa balance transfer. Good through December 31st, 2012. That's a really big deal. And you heard that right. Our really big deal, 3.9% APR, is good through December 31st, 2012. And we don't charge you a balance transfer fee. So if you use any other credit card to pay for your holiday purchases, move those high interest rate balances to your PSECU Visa. The sooner you get in on this really big deal, the more you'll save. Financing Life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or go to PSECU.com/life. Get in on our really big deal Visa balance transfer. Don't wait. Start saving.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
Hi, I'm Bob Snyder, president of Teamsters Local 776 here in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. For more than 100 years, Teamsters have been standing together to create a better tomorrow. We Teamster members are your friends and neighbors. Teamsters move goods across the nation, take care of seniors, serve and protect our community, and so much more. We are hardworking, dedicated professional workers, united to make our lives, our communities, and our nation stronger. If you want to be part of the team, join the Teamsters for a better tomorrow. Contact us at 1-800-692-6280. That's 1-800-692-6280. Or visit our website at TeamstersLocal776.org. We are people helping people.
Waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Remember, you can check out the website at therickssmithshow.com if you missed any portion of the program. Right there, you can download the podcast. You know, we've been talking a lot about the budget. And this really, and he makes, Representative Sterla makes an excellent point that we don't want to pit our kindergartners against our college-age kids. We don't want to pit infants against seniors. We don't want to pit people against each other. We don't want to get into that divisiveness. That's what the right does. That's what the radicals over there do. They want to pit groups against each other. This is about society as a whole. What's important? And you look at the debt that we have, especially on the federal level, and right now they're saying that, you know, our federal debt is now over $14 trillion. I guess $14.2 trillion as of today. Joshua Holland over at Alternate did a nice piece on this called Five Fun Facts About the $14 Trillion Debt, where he goes into talking about the idea that we've always been in debt. The country has always been in debt. In fact, before there really was even a country, we were more than $75 million in debt. Before we were even a nation, yet we were in deep debt. And, you know, it wasn't until 1835 that we got down to almost debt-free of $34,000. During you know, the World War II period, however, we were up to 120% of our GDP. So the question then becomes, where was the moment when we were debt free? Some like to say the 50s, and we had some good years during the 50s. The last time we had a balanced budget in my lifetime were those couple of years under Bill Clinton. So it's kind of an interesting argument that the right seems to be making, that there's all this debt and it's Obama's fault for doing it. And if you go back and you take a look at exactly who ran up the debt, it's pretty convincing that it wasn't. Because Joshua writes, between 1960 and 2010, federal spending as a share of the economy has bounced around within a fairly narrow range, between 17.7% under Eisenhower to 21.8% during George Bush's first term. The first George Bush, or his only term, actually. Republicans are just as happy to spend, but they run on tax cuts, and the result is that since the middle of the last century, contrary to tax and spend label, it's been Democrats who have been far more conservative when it comes to keeping deficits under control. And they go back to Ronald Reagan when he took over the country, and I've talked about this ad nauseum, but his numbers are there as well. When he took control, we were about $930 million in debt. Thereabout. By the end of his term, he increased that debt to $2.7 trillion. At a compound interest of about 13.7%. This increase, massive. He had never a balanced budget. Bush's father took over with $2.7 trillion in debt, jumped that up to 4%, $4 trillion, more than a 10% compound annual increase. He never balanced a budget. When Clinton took office, $4 trillion in debt. Now, when he left, it was up to 5.6, but the amount of annual increase was just 4.2%. He balanced his last three budgets. He gave George W. Bush a balanced budget, a surplus for as far as the eye could see. And what was the little shrub's first inclination? Let's give that money away to the very wealthy. So he gave out massive tax breaks. Massive amounts of tax dollars he gave out. So in his 8 years, we went from $5.6 trillion in the hole to over $10 trillion in the hole. So now understand, when Obama took office, we were already $10 trillion in the hole with a deficit of the future year of 2009 of $1.2 trillion, no matter who was going to be president. Didn't matter. Could have been John McCain, could have been Jesus Christ. Didn't matter. It was going to be $1.2 trillion. So he had an annual increase of almost 10%. Slightly more than the rate that's grown during Obama's first years. Now understand that. When you look at it in real numbers, not just what's being thrown out there, what's being pushed down our throats, Republicans have been horrible for the debt. They've done everything they can do to run it up. And this idea that, well, it's the Chinese. The Chinese are our bankers. The Chinese own everything. And while I'm some fears the growth of the Chinese, especially when you talk about manufacturing, the reality is they only hold just under 10% of our outstanding debt. Do you know who holds the largest percent of our debt, Jake? Any idea? We do. We hold over 42% of our own debt because we buy T-bills from the government for our pension funds, for 401ks, for our children. We own our own debt. And our government owns a good portion of our debt because Social Security. Understand that, because Social Security is investing that money, you guessed it, into IOUs. Remember back during the campaign when Bush was wanting to privatize Social Security, going around with the filing cabinet saying, you know what? There's a whole basement full of filing cabinets, full of IOUs. Never mind that those IOUs were backed by the full faith and credit of the federal government. Never mind that. No, no, no. So this whole canard that they're throwing out, the debt's too big, those are most of it's investments that you and I are making in our country. Now, I do fear some of the borrowing that we have done. We've gotten a little bit, had we done, Jake, I think like we should have when it comes to the war and maybe issued war bonds. That'd have been, if you're not going to be willing to raise taxes, maybe war bonds.
Well, if I remember, that's what we did in World War II. You have all talked, Rick, and I think you're right. Long term, what's probably more important, and we can see the devastating effect, is our trade deficit. That has just killed this country.
Absolutely. And the reality being, we've never paid for our wars. And that's something we need to talk about. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, I want to talk about the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire. This is the 100th anniversary. An amazing, amazing tragedy. Ted Schmuckler, Policy Director, Interfaith Worker Justice, after this.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Much of the success of American law enforcement can be traced to this important reality. Criminals tend to be stupid. In other words, they catch themselves. On the other hand, much of the failure of American law enforcement can be traced to another important reality. Our criminal laws tend to be stupider than our criminals. Take the Combat Meth Act of 2004. It prompted various states to set up electronic systems for limiting and tracking the sales of pseudoephedrine, the widely used cold medicine. These pills are good for easing the dripping and sniffling that come with colds and allergies. But pseudoephedrine is also good for making something bad. Methamphetamine, the savagely addictive drug that is a scourge of communities across the country, especially in rural areas. Thus, banning over-the-counter sales of pseudoephedrine and rationing the amount each customer can buy was well-intentioned. But restricting its sale has created a very lucrative black market for the pills, luring thousands of new peddlers, hustlers, and opportunists into the illicit meth underworld. Meth brokers and producers recruit legions of friends, homeless people, college kids eager for quick cash, and even their own children to go pharmacy to pharmacy, with each smurfer, as they are called, buying the limit on pills. Using store specials and even clipping coupons, they can buy a box of pseudoephedrine for $8, then sell the pills to meth producers for $50. That's a nice profit for 30 minutes or so of their time. This is Jim Hightower saying, so while this drug war on cold pills has added inconvenience to legitimate customers and expense to pharmacies, it has failed to curb the meth trade and has created a booming new network of black market criminals for the police to chase. Can we now admit that this is stupid and try something else?
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at HightowerLowdown.com.
Radio of, for, and by, we the working people. The Rick Smith Show.
Today, the 100th anniversary of the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire in New York City took the lives of 146 young women. They were either burnt to death or fell to their death. This disaster, you know, it was one that is credited for launching a national movement for safer working conditions. And then you go to this day back in 1947, an explosion at a coal mine in Centralia, Illinois, killed 111 miners. The mine workers president at the time, John L. Lewis, called for a 6-day work stoppage by the nation's 400,000 soft coal miners to demand safer working conditions. And, you know, as the years go by, we keep seeing this issue coming up over and over and over again. And now it's our turn to take this up. That's why I think it's important to remember these moments and to reflect upon them, talk about them, and educate ourselves. That's why I've asked Ted Smuckler, Policy Director at Interfaith Worker Justice, IWJ.org, to come talk to us a little bit. Ted, thanks for taking time for me.
Thank you, Rick.
You know, some of the lessons learned from this, I think today we should be focusing on, such as why collective bargaining is so important, why having a voice at work is so important.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, when you look at the tragedy 100 years ago, one of the main causes of it was that the bosses locked the door in the back of the factory. The women who were immigrant Jewish women and immigrant Italian women, in their early 20s, young, ended up having to throw themselves out of the window to escape this fire, throw themselves out an eight-story window and end up crashing to death.
And the reasons for this, you know, you go back to that period and you read the history of it. At the time, wage theft was a huge part of their complaints, not just at this factory, but through the industry in New York, which led to massive strikes. Some 70,000 of these shirtwaist manufacturers, these employees going to the streets fighting for a say in wages, a say in conditions. And ironically, it was the Triangle factory that ultimately did not have collective bargaining rights.
Right. And unfortunately, it's 100 years later, and wages are still being stolen from unorganized workers. Particularly in industries like the shirtwaist factory, in garment industries in Los Angeles, and in the Filipino immigrants and others in these industries are having their wages stolen still.
Yeah, I mean, in looking at this historical moment, I mean, there's so many lessons, reasons for collective bargaining, reasons for immigration reform at our time, reasons for labor law reform so that we don't have the theft of wages. I mean, just so much from this that was back then, 100 years ago, we're still dealing with today.
Definitely. And also, it's so ironic that on this anniversary day, just yesterday, we find out that the governor of Wisconsin and the same legislator that took away collective bargaining rights from public workers, in the dead of night without violating the Open Meetings Act in Wisconsin, that they are planning to take away paid sick days from Milwaukee workers. In 2008, the city of Milwaukee passed an ordinance guaranteeing 9 paid sick days. Protect the health and safety of workers and their their customers, the people they came into contact with. Well, the Chamber of Commerce sued to get an injunction against enforcing that law. And in the last, I don't know if it was yesterday or the day before, but a judge put a stay on that injunction, and the law is going through.
Yeah, so
now the state legislature wants to preempt Milwaukee's law, that a city cannot pass a law to protect workers' health and safety.
I mean, it's just mind-boggling that, and we're not just seeing it in Wisconsin. We're seeing it in Wisconsin, Indiana, Ohio, Michigan,
right.
Tennessee. 37 states across the country are in some shape or form attacking workers' rights. We see in New Hampshire, they just passed not only taking collective bargaining rights away, but making New Hampshire an at-will state. To me, we are going absolutely in the wrong direction, Ted.
Yes, I totally agree. And the only good news out of this is I think, the far right wing people who are behind this and the business interests that are behind them were not expecting the kind of resistance and public outrage that's occurred. And, in the past 10, 20, 30 years, there's been such a shrinkage in the organized labor share of the workforce, right? And in the private sector, it's very low. In the public sector, it's higher altogether. It's below 12%. And the business people and the right wing have been licking their chops to finally do in labor. And they've been having this conversation that you know, the problem with our economy is because is that our workers are overpaid. The reason for budget deficits is that state workers are somehow pampered.
Yeah, and, you know, I ask most of my working friends, and all of my friends are working class people, are you making too much?
And what do they tell you, Rick?
Well, they're like me. They're paying their bills. They're getting by. We don't take lavish vacations. We don't have luxury automobiles or fly on private jets or vacation on private islands. We're working people. That stuff is for the Alan Mulally's of the world who got almost $57 million in stock options here recently.
You know, if the 8 richest people in Wisconsin paid 1% more in income taxes, there would be no state deficit in Wisconsin.
Well, again, you know, it's somehow, if you remember them talking about a bus driver who made $159,000, they were just all enraged. The media went nuts. But when you look at someone like the CEO from Johnson & Johnson who got nearly $29 million for the company losing money, they're okay with that.
Right. I just saw in the newspaper today, GE paid no taxes last year and got tax benefits.
Yep.
Back from taxes. So, yeah, it's ridiculous. In Michigan, they passed a law basically empowering emergency managers who were appointed by the governor, not elected by anybody.
Yep, we've got little kings.
Right, that they can dissolve union contracts. They can just take away union contracts in schools and in cities that they call failing. Well, you know, what schools and cities are those going to be? What schools are always called failing? They're schools in areas where the people are black and brown or, you know, very low income.
Yeah, it's just those people, though. We don't care about those.
Right, right.
We don't care about those people.
Are failing. We're going to tear up the union contracts because these teachers are not good because they're in these failing schools. And the law even gives them the power, these emergency managers elected by no one, to dissolve city governments and, you know, reappoint others. So we're talking about a tax that are at their fundamental core, tax of democracy itself.
Well, here's the thing that bothers me, and as policy director at Interfaith Worker Justice, maybe you'll have a take on it that is unique to mine. We do all of the things that we're talking about, cutting education, cutting social programs, cutting food stamp programs, cutting all of this stuff, balancing our budgets on the backs of those least able to defend themselves, least capable of paying it, and least able to afford the massive cuts, and yet we call ourselves, or the right calls this, a Christian nation.
Yeah, well, somebody wrote a sermon for our materials for, April 4th is a giant day of action,
right,
under the banner of We Are One, with faith community and labor unions and civil rights organizations all coming together across the country to say no to the attacks on worker rights. So somebody wrote a sermon for us that mentioned that Governor Scott Walker in Wisconsin told people that he's a believer in Jesus, and he encourages other people to believe likewise. And this person in the sermon questioned, just which Jesus did he profess to believe in? Is it the Jesus that hung around with poor people and talked about how the rich need to go through the eye of a needle to get to heaven? It's as hard as a camel going through the eye of the needle. Who said to take care of the poor and the least of us? You know, that's, it's what version of Christianity is this? I mean, there's some versions of religion here that celebrate prosperity and say that if you're wealthy, you know, God's showing favor on you. But that, it's definitely not, not the teachings of Judaism, of real Christianity, of Islam, or of any major faith that believes in justice.
And just so folks know, I got about a minute here. What do you guys do at Interfaith Worker Justice?
We're a national organization that organizes the faith community, future religious leaders, students, and worker centers in support of working issues.
Yeah, it takes me back to my, I grew up in the Catholic Church where they, at that time, believed in peace and social justice. Now they seem to have taken a decidedly rightward turn on the abortion issue, and that seems to be the only issue that seems to matter to most of my Catholic friends. But
well, Catholic social teaching is very clear on the right to organize, the free association, on the dignity of every human being, and that basically the workers have a right to associate. It comes even back in the 1890s, the Pope issued a statement saying that clearly working people must form associations to defend themselves, and that part of what we are is social human beings, as people who have the rights to defend themselves. And, even this current Pope has reiterated that. So it's not, the Catholic Church has very strong teachings on economic justice.
Yeah, I agree. But, most of the folks that I know, they're tied to that abortion issue. That seems to be all that matters anymore. Anyway, Ted Smuckler, Public Policy Director, Interfaith Worker Justice, IWJ.org. I appreciate your time and thank you, for giving us a little information on this really sad anniversary.
Well, thank you. And just let people know that April 4th is the day of action. Go to our website to find out more.
All righty. Thanks so much, Ted.
Okay, thank you.
We're going to take a quick break right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425.
I'm with you now. Until the end.
Thought-provoking, intelligent conversation with a heart. The voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
Our workers' comp system is a confusing maze of rules, delays, and loopholes, where workers struggle to collect what they are owed. Bills don't get paid, and families struggle to put food on the table after a serious work injury. What happens when you're injured on the job in Pennsylvania? Most people think you just apply for workers' comp, and you'll get paid for lost time, and your medical bills will be covered. Sadly, in Pennsylvania, that is not the case. The good news is, it doesn't have to be that way. Hi, I'm Ron Calhoun, and I'm a Central Pennsylvania workers' compensation attorney. It's my job to make sure injured workers receive the benefits they deserve. In the last 20 years, I have helped hundreds of Pennsylvania workers and their families after they've suffered from a work injury. If you've been injured on the job, I'd like the chance to show you how I might be able to do the same for you. Why not find out what you're rightfully owed? Call me at 717-695-4722. You have nothing to lose and much to gain. Call me at 695-4722.
Chances are, when you took a shower this morning, an AFSCME member made sure that water was clean. When you drove to work, an AFSCME member maintained the road. When you rode an elevator, an AFSCME member inspected it. I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. The work isn't glamorous, the salaries aren't high, but AFSCME members serve the public in every aspect of our daily lives. Chances are, you'll never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org. We are AFSCME.
We make Pennsylvania happen!
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
I break again the rocks in the hot sun. I broke the law in the law on. I broke the law in the law on.
I remember on Monday, 11:30, Capitol steps here in Harrisburg. There's going to be a rally of people from around the state on education saying, look, you know what, Governor, we don't think you should be cutting higher education. We don't think you should be cutting education at all. But there is going to be a bunch of college students, educators, citizen activists coming out and talking about this budget. And I think, I look back today in history, and I do look a lot back to history for where we need to go. And on this day back in 1894, That marked what was the first Poor People's March on Washington, in which jobless workers demanded the creation of public works programs. It was led by a guy named Jacob Coxey. And you've heard the thing, Coxey's army, somewhere between 500 and 1,000 people marched from Massillon, Ohio, through Pennsylvania and Maryland to camp in Washington, D.C. And I got to be honest, I've been waiting really and calling for the next Jacob Coxey. You know, I've made this plea several times because we have millions of unemployed. And I would love to see those millions of unemployed take to the streets like they did back on this day in 1894. Just like today, those workers were, you know, they were in deep depression at the time. We were in a major downturn. But they demanded their government to do something besides continuing to cater to the wealthy. And, you know, like I've been saying, you know, the more things change, the more they seem to stay the same. You know, back in 1894, they were suffering from the Great Panic of 1893, which workers saw their jobs just disappear. And just like 2009, workers, or 2008, workers were pitched into the streets. So when is government going to do something to create jobs, to build roads and bridges, other public works programs? When are we going to do the things desperately needed? And I'm saying, you know, education is not the place to start destroying just yet, especially when you're talking about, Jake, they're talking about $833 million in tax handouts through this scheme that they've dreamt up. They continue to allow all that money to flow out of the states through the P.O. box in Delaware, through the Delaware loophole. And we're still not seriously talking about going after the drillers who, as Mike Sterla said, want to be taxed just so they can get that monkey off their back.
That is amazing, Rick. You know, the hole we're in, that would be easy. That would be simple to close that loophole. I mean, we don't even go in, and you know, we don't even pick the low-hanging fruit. You know, taxing smokeless tobacco and taxing cigars. We're one of the, I think smokeless tobacco were the only state. Cigars were one of two. That would be easy. And you would think at a time when we need money desperately, instead of taking it from education and taking it from programs which fulfill basic human needs of the people of Pennsylvania, that you would do something that, and here's another thing. You're talking about smokeless tobacco and you talk about cigars. It impacts health. You can justify adding a tax and say, look, you know, your smoking is adding to the cost of health care. And this is just our way of saying you're going to pay some of that cost. But even in that situation, Rick, they don't want to do it for purely ideological reasons. Makes no sense.
It doesn't make much sense. And, you know, at some point, I'm waiting for that explosion. And I think it's starting to happen. I mean, you look at what happened in Wisconsin. That was an amazing moment. And talking to some of the folks, it really caught them by surprise that there was that much anger around this, and that you saw so many people coming out, families coming out, people who, and like I've said, you know, I met numerous folks who said they had lived their entire lives in the state of Wisconsin and never once been to their capital. You know, I wonder how many people in this state have never been to their house, which is the Capitol building right here, had their voice heard. I'm saying this could be a moment of epic empowerment where you have an actual citizens movement of people who say, you know what? We're not going to cut education. That's the future. We're not going to pit kindergartners against college students. Not going to happen. We're not going to pit granny against the newborn. Not going to happen. We're going to take care of the people who need to be taken care of. We're going to make sure that this is a place that we all want to prosper in. Now, we've got to pay for that. And call it what you want. Call it a contribution. Call it a gift, whatever. But the folks who have the biggest shoulders should be the ones carrying a little bit more of the weight. You know, right when all this started, And we have talked about this, Jake, that we were going to go and balance the budgets on the backs of those who really cannot afford to have these cuts. These folks are already at the margins. So what do you then do? And again, I go back to the very same reality of, and I'll give Corbett a pass. I'll give you a pass. Just do what's right.
Well, make a mistake. The rightward leaning Republican Party. I mean, I'm saying leaning. It's actually run to the right. Has a dramatic impact in Pennsylvania. I mean, these right wingers have. See this as an opportunity that may not come along, and they're probably right. The opportunity like this may not come along again in quite a while where their party has control of both houses and the governor's office. In Pennsylvania, that doesn't happen very often. It has not happened very often in the history of this state. And they see some things that they've wanted for a long, long time, and this is a chance to seize it. And then you have the huge influx of special interest money. And that's a 1-2 punch that's going to be hard to beat,
which
unfortunately
is,
for the people of Pennsylvania.
You know, which is why when you look at this and you say, look, you know, poll after poll says raise the Marcellus jail tax, and the industry wants it, and you've got a recalcitrant governor who's tied to this really bizarre pledge. And again, it goes back to my premise that, look, they're good at campaigning. They make all of these campaign pledges that they know they know are dangerous. They make all these gimmicky pledges that they know are going to harm us. But it is politic after all.
Well, but he's covering himself too on that Marcellus Shale. He says he'll wait till he hears from his advisory panel, and then you look at the advisory panel. It's, I mean, I'm chuckling. It's not really funny. It's about 3-1. Skewed on the side of the industry. You know what kind of recommendation. I've already read some of them. I mean, they're already making excuses for some of the excesses of the industry.
And look, I don't blame the industry. I really don't.
Doing what they can.
If you can get away with it, go right on ahead. If we're too ideologically opposed, if we're too bullheaded, if we're too stupid, to do what everybody else is doing, then maybe we need to get whacked around a little bit.
Well, the problem with that philosophy is when you're talking about the process that they use to extract natural gas, you're talking about chemicals getting into some of these aquifers that will have a tremendous negative effect on water supply in a huge area.
Well, you know,
for a long time.
Then, you know, maybe we need that pain and suffering. You can't talk to some people. You can't have conversations where you say, this is coming. They just don't seem to get it.
The problem is that some of this damage, Rick, when it reaches a certain point, there'll be no turning back. And that's the shame of it. They could do damage to the water supply of the people of Pennsylvania far into the future.
You don't need water. But that'd be good for the industry to get bottled water. Buy bottled water. See, there's always a plan, always a for-profit plan. If we can screw up your drinking water, we'll just sell it to you. If they screw up the air, I'll just sell it to you. Good conservative ideology, good worldview. Everything you pay for. My father-in-law was just telling me, everything in South Carolina you pay for. You park to go to the beach, you got to pay for it. You want to take the ferry, big money. You want to go here, you got to park to pay for that. Everything is pay. You're all in conservative world. Get used to reaching in your pocket, because
I'm sure that I know that the corporate interest down there don't pay a lot of taxes.
Well, it is that. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk about the big march on Monday, because I think it's important. We're going to talk with Professor Kenneth Mash from East Stroudsburg University. We're right back after this.
Not right wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show.
Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. Workers, unions, and their community allies are rallying in Los Angeles Saturday for jobs and community as they express solidarity with Wisconsin and other worker struggles around the country. Teamsters President James Hoffa.
What we're seeing here is the biggest attack on organized labor and the middle class that we've seen in the past 20 years. This is basically the right wing, the far right wing, the Tea Party. They've taken over six governorships, and they are attacking labor across the board. We are fighting back, and here in Los Angeles, this Saturday, we're going to have a march of over 15,000 people to talk about that we're not going backwards, we're not giving up our union rights, we're not going to give up our dreams for the middle class.
Hoffa says forging a long-term movement to take political power away from anti-union right-wingers is one goal of a re-energized workers' movement. And he says people are in a fight-back mood.
People who are under attack, the thousands of people that showed up in Madison, Wisconsin, the thousands of people that are showing up across the country with these demonstrations, the thousands of people are going to show up here in Los Angeles to basically say, hey, we're mad as hell. We're going to fight back. We're not going to let you take away our lives, our dreams.
The Los Angeles Labor Rally this weekend will help build a National Day of Labor Action, April 4th, the anniversary of the 1968 assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. as he stood in solidarity with public workers in Memphis.
The Associated Press has analyzed numbers in the land of Lincoln and learned that nearly 97% of state workers have union representation. Out of 50,000 state workers, that leaves roughly 1,700 not in a union. According to AP, in the last 8 years alone, Illinois has seen a four-fold increase in union representation. Illinois Governor Pat Quinn has denounced Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker's anti-labor legislation, but at the same time, he's been seeking support from the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees to allow thousands of workers to fall outside of the union's scope. The concern is that the situation leaves very few managers. The AP says the surge in the scope of employees joining unions, including non-traditional union-represented positions, such as prison wardens and chiefs of staff, was due to the administration of Rod Blagojevich, who had a poor relationship with state employees. What do we need for unions to step in and provide the voice for employees that the eventually ousted governor was ignoring? If Quinn can't reach a compromise with AFSCME, legislation could be introduced that would remove the collective bargaining rights of employees that were allowed to join unions since the start of 2009.
This newscast made possible in part through underwriting from the AFL-CIO and by the National Association of Letter Carriers. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Your working class radio experience, where hard work, common sense, and rational thought are a reality. The Rick Smith Show.
Working hard to make a left, rich and father red. Father son left the cameo, blue denim, cat as great.
I look at this this piece that was in the People's World magazine. They from Miami, they're talking about education, and the nation's largest public college is going to be offering free education. Now, across the country, we're seeing massive cuts in education, but Miami-Dade College, the largest public education of higher learning and learning in the country, it says will offer free admission starting next quarter to qualified local graduates. The qualifications, pretty simple. You have to have a B average. You have to be a resident, pass the entrance exam, and apply for financial aid, and they will make sure that you have the ability to get up to 60 credits. That, to me, sounds like a step in the right direction, not cutting 54% of our budget. Anyway, on Monday, 11:30 in the morning, there is going to be a protest rally, whatever you want to call it, citizens coming to their house, having their voice heard. Professor Kenneth Mash, professor at East Stroudsburg University, I understand is going to be there. Professor, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you very much.
You're going to be here on Monday, right?
I am going to be there Monday, and I'm going to be there with a lot of students. So
why is this important?
Well, you know, this is really important, I think, because, you know, it may just be that students were an easy target because students don't usually, you know, studies show that students don't vote the same rate that other people vote. So it may be that, you know, people took students for granted. And I think that when Monday comes along, they'll see that really what just happened was there was a sleeping giant that woke up.
You know, when we went to Wisconsin, we spent a little over a week there in Wisconsin during the height of the activity. And I got to be honest with you, it was the college students that led the entire thing. It was the college kids who took over and really became the main activists.
Right. And was initiated by a student at ABSCUS. We've helped out. Helped them organize as much as we possibly can. But it's really the students who are really the energy behind it. And we're really glad because we have, at this point, like 15 to 20 buses of students, and, you know, they wouldn't be coming unless we can get students to be on them.
Wow, that sounds like it's going to be a pretty sizable rally. We are going to be there covering the event because I think this is the kind of stuff that absolutely has to get out to the folks to see that, you know what, there are people angry about this budget cut. Because what's going on right now, the spin that we're getting from the little tinky tank here in Harrisburg with their way out radical conservative thought is that nobody's really upset. We don't see mass protests. We don't see people upset. So they must not be all that upset because the silent majority is okay with cutting education and cutting the things that the governor's going after.
Yeah, I really think that that's a total misconception. And it really, you know, totally misses what we do. That is the faculty, particularly at, you know, the state system of higher education schools, the people that we serve are the working class of Pennsylvania. And those are the people who, you know, if they've had children go, or they've had brothers and sisters go to our schools, but we're the ones that are able to provide for them opportunities. And, you know, as corny as it sounds, we're really helping them achieve the American dream. I mean, they may not otherwise be able to afford to go to college. And, you know, I hear from my students, you know, they may not be able to afford even a small increase next year. Our president gave his speech talking about what might be happening with the budget, one of our students got up and said, you know, tell me, please, should I be now, making plans to come back here in the fall, or should I be filling out an application at McDonald's? And that's serious.
That is serious. Because I don't know that parents, tuition rates have been going through the roof for the last several years as is, and now you're seeing even the small amount that the state was investing in this, you're seeing them wanting to cut 54% of it, which I got to be honest is just way out of line with what I think is reality.
Right. And, you know, to stop and think that at one time Commonwealth picked up two-thirds the cost of an education at one of our schools, and now we've reached the point where it's, you know, less than a third that the Commonwealth is picking up, and then you chop that in half, you start to wonder, you know, to what degree is there any commitment at all by the Commonwealth? And our chancellor last Wednesday at the Senate appropriation hearing, you know, he had a moment where he was, you know, really eloquent when he said, you know, the Commonwealth made, in essence, a covenant with the people of the Commonwealth when they set up these schools. And it's necessary. It's a promise to the people of Pennsylvania, and particularly the working people of Pennsylvania, that the Commonwealth continue to offer this kind of education.
I agree. You know, I've heard some reports, and maybe you'll be able to speak to it a little better than I, that if these stand, the possibility of closing one of the 14 state-owned, state-operated institutions is a very real possibility.
Well, it is, you know, one of the members of the board, at least, has come out and said that it might mean closing. Of course, it's hard to imagine that, you know, next year they can close the school because of the chaos that would ensue. I mean, our universities, they've already started admitting classes for next year. They've already made promises to students for next year. It would be very difficult to turn around in one particular year, but you could just see, I mean, the university are not in a position to have massive layoffs of faculty for next year. It's difficult to see, and the point we keep on making over and over and over again, it's not even a matter of, boy, this would be really hard to live with these cuts. It's a matter of, it's just no way it could work. And certainly no way that it could work beginning in the fall that we're going to have this kind of shortfall. We're talking about 15%, really, of the budgets of these schools. And one point that's made over and over again by a lot of our faculty is, if even if we were looking at a business, and a lot of people like to use business models when they look at universities, but if we were looking at a business and we said, we're going to deprive 15% of the revenue to a business from one year to the next, you know, that business would go into Chapter 11 bankruptcy.
Right.
At that. And so we're talking about really, you know, it may be the death knell for our universities. And they certainly could not deliver the kind of education that they do right now.
Well, let me ask you this. You know, I have some conservative friends who say, you know what, it's not a core government function. What you guys do, it should be left to the private free market to decide, and we shouldn't be using tax dollars for it. Thoughts?
Well, you know, that's just in my opinion, that's a very short-sighted view. And it's the kind of view which is, in the end, not very democratic. You know, to have a democracy, you want a well-educated public. I mean, just on that principle alone, you want enough people in your society who, you know what's going on in the world and can make quality decisions. But even beyond that, even if it's just about selfish purposes, many of the Republicans have been saying that, you know, what we have to focus on is jobs, jobs, jobs. And I get that point. But one wants to know, you know, what kind of jobs, jobs, jobs are we talking about? If Pennsylvania is not the kind of place where people can go, you know, that companies can go to because they're expecting a well-educated workforce, what kind of jobs are going to be available to them?
Excellent point.
You know, what kind of, in the end, what kind of jobs are going to be available for the people there? They're going to be low-paying jobs. And that's not what we want for the future. We want to be able to have high-paying jobs because it's better for everyone. I mean, you have high-paying jobs, people pay more taxes.
And again,
that's the story, you know, that individuals are saying, if you listen around, telling their story about how they started off from humble means and they went to one of our universities and, you know, not necessarily became rich, but got quality jobs. And in the end, you know, here they are for years now, 20 years, 30 years, you know, they're paying taxes back. They're giving back to the Commonwealth.
Productive members of society. And that's, to me, again, you know, I talk about this quite often because, you know, as a kid, I grew up in a housing project on the west side of Cleveland. There were a couple of times when my mother was on, when we were on welfare, a couple of times when we needed public assistance for health care. But through the helping hand of our government, the investment that was made in me, I'm a pretty sizable taxpayer.
Right. And, you know, we serve, you know, maybe not most anymore, but, you know, a substantial number of our students are first generation college students. They're the first people in their family. And it's, you say that about you. You know, it's true about me, too. You know, I was first-generation college student. I didn't live in the Commonwealth. I lived in New York. I went to the City University of New York, Queens College. You know, that's the kind of school that we're talking about when we're talking about our schools, you know, where we have people who are going for, you know, an education that's relatively low-priced. But, again, it provides an opportunity because I don't think I could have went to college. And I, you know, many of my students, I don't know, you know, would they be able to continue? And I think each one of my colleagues, you know, hearing this news, our first concern is we go to our classes, we look into the eyes of our students, and we wonder which one of these students won't be able to get back here next year.
Man, that's a sad prospect. So Monday, 11:30 a.m. Here on the Capitol steps here in Harrisburg. Make sure you're here. I'm looking forward to a very sizable turnout because, you know, this is how our system's set up. Come to your house and have your voice heard.
Yeah, it's going to be great. We're going to have students from Bloomsburg, Westchester, Shippensburg, Millsville, Indiana University of Pennsylvania, Kutztown, Lock Haven, Mansfield. So from all over the place, and we're really excited. I hope we get to see other people show up, too.
Yeah, we will be there, and I'm hoping others will show up as well. Again, 11:30 a.m. Here at the Capitol Steps here in Harrisburg. Professor Mash, I appreciate your time. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. Right back after this, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Back after this.
Making the blue blood see red. The Rick Smith Show.
Much of the success of American law enforcement can be traced to this important reality. Criminals tend to be stupid. In other words, they catch themselves. On the other hand, much of the failure of American law enforcement can be traced to another important reality. Our criminal laws tend to be stupider than our criminals. Take the Combat Meth Act of 2004. It prompted various states to set up electronic systems for limiting and tracking the sales of pseudoephedrine, the widely used cold medicine. These pills are good for easing the dripping and sniffling that come with colds and allergies. But pseudoephedrine is also good for making something bad. Methamphetamine, the savagely addictive drug that is a scourge of communities across the country, especially in rural areas. Thus, banning over-the-counter sales of pseudoephedrine and rationing the amount each customer can buy was well-intentioned. But restricting its sale has created a very lucrative black market of the pills, luring thousands of new peddlers, hustlers, and opportunists into the illicit meth underworld. Meth brokers and producers recruit legions of friends, homeless people, college kids eager for quick cash, and even their own children to go pharmacy to pharmacy, with each smurfer, as they are called, buying the limit on pills. Using store specials and even clipping coupons, they can buy a box of pseudoephedrine for $8, then sell the pills to meth producers for $50. That's a nice profit for 30 minutes or so of their time. This is Jim Hightower saying, so while this drug war on cold pills has added inconvenience to legitimate customers and expense to pharmacies, it has failed to curb the meth trade and has created a booming new network of black market criminals for the police to chase. Can we now admit that this is stupid and try something else?
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at HightowerLowdown.org.
Your proud defender of the American dream, Rick Smith.
Rick, 1-888-520-7425. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, you can download the podcast there for your entertainment, your enjoyment. The 2012 Republican field is kind of shaping up to be, well, kind of anticlimactic. I mean, it's a whole bunch of bizarre characters, but I don't know that anyone's really distinguished themselves. Iowa Republican Chuck Grassley doesn't seem to have much faith in his party's field either, because he was asked in a Radio Iowa interview, you know, what he thought, and he said, "Well, only two or three of them are qualified to be president." And look, you know, at the end of it, you've got some folks who are out there for the sole purpose of, "Hey, look at me, buy my book." And I'm still backing. I think I may change my voter registration to Republican just so I can vote for the one California businessman, the very first Republican to announce his nomination or his seeking the presidency, a guy named Fred Karger, who is openly gay, an active feminist, and is pro-gay marriage, pro-abortion, pro-everything. The complete antithesis of the Republican Party and everything that they seem to stand for. So, interesting. And this is kind of what I've been saying. What you need You need people to get back into the Republican Party to make it not such a homogenous party. Give it some color. Give it a little flavor. You know, mix up the white folks with somebody else.
Okay. I mean, California and the Republican side, Rick, has a long history of nominating moderate Republicans. I think he would do okay in California. Nationally, he wouldn't have a prayer. In most states, he would probably get about 2% if he's lucky.
You're going to get the gay Republican vote. Well, you know, hey, they're out there. You know, and it comes down to money.
The log cabin Republicans.
Comes down to money. A new Gallup poll is out and saying that the front runners of the Republican party for their nomination are Huckleberry and Romney. Huckleberry has about 19% of the vote, according to Gallup. Romney has about 15%. It's interesting that Sarah Palin has fallen, and her star seems to be falling like a rock, probably because people are going, really, she's not all that bright.
Well, I think they've realized she really doesn't want, I don't think she wants to be anyway. She's making too much money, having too much fun. I mean, when you think about it, she's making tours overseas. I mean, they actually open their arms for her and treat her as, you know, an emissary of the United States government. I'm thinking, why?
Yeah, exactly. Why?
Why?
Don't even give her a room don't leave the light on for her at Motel 6. I mean, really, come on. Another presidential candidate, Haley Barbour, the Mississippi governor, he's defending his use of the state-owned plane. He says, you know, he comes to Washington, you know, for a speech for conservative activists. He says, as we told the Associated Press, I'll tell you that compared to my predecessor, my hours on our state plane are almost exactly the same. Haley, listen up. Haley, listen up. You were in one of the poorest states in the country. Over $7,000 to take a trip to Washington just for the weekend is a bit excessive. There are people who don't even make $7,000 a year in your state. Haley, listen up.
I believe it's the poorest state, right?
$300,000 he spent in 2010, according to the Clarion Ledger in Jackson, Mississippi. $300,000. You don't think that $300,000 could have, helped a whole bunch of really low-income people? But that's not who they're there for.
No.
Not at all.
His rationale is, well, you know, I'm eating at the public trough, but I'm not eating as much as my predecessor. So that makes it okay.
Yeah. You know, yeah, even though I'm bigger than you are, it would be like me following you on the trolley.
Well, you know, he's kind of like Republican royalty. If you look at his lineage, Rick, yeah, I mean, yeah. You know, he's been, he's come from.
He was the top dog.
He was the top dog in the Republican Party for a while there. And quite frankly, I think from the perspective of his party, he did a decent job. He's well respected within his party. Now, that doesn't mean I agree with him, certainly not. But actually, and I never thought I'd say this, when I look at the Republicans and Haley Barbour has really come out as some moderate. I mean, he's actually said some things which makes some logical sense, which some of them won't. They won't say anything that could be construed as giving tacit approval to anything that Barack Obama does.
Yeah. They can't. I mean, which is kind of weird about this whole thing with Libya. And while, again, I'm not at all in favor of it, I think it was I'm one of the people who are completely against it. It's interesting how Gingrich has jumped back and forth. Gingrich has kind of been all over. He's been the Mexican
looking. His credibility has really sunk to an all-time low. 2 weeks ago, he said, well, if it was up to me, I'd declare a no-fly zone tonight.
Yeah, and we'd have ground troops in there.
So what does Barack Obama do? He jumps on board.
And then he didn't do it soon enough.
Yeah, wrong thing to do. He didn't handle it right. I mean, come on. It's obvious that some of the Republicans, their philosophy is whatever Barack Obama decides, we are on the other side.
And no matter what it is, even if it's right. Speaking of plane problems, seems as Senator Claire McCaskill's having her share of plane problems. the Missouri Democrat who was up for re-election in 2012, tweeted this afternoon, tough week, important to keep my problems in perspective, going to continue to be up front and keep working. We'll blog more later. Here's her problem. Evidently, she admitted, I guess, the failing to pay about $287,000 in personal property taxes on a charter plane that she co-owns with her husband and some investors. So they're going after her, beating her up pretty good, because, you know, they've been pummeling her. And I guess an ethics complaint by the Missouri GOP is coming, because claiming that she improperly used the plane for a political trip, for which she was reimbursed by taxpayers. So it's, you know, again, you love watching this war go back and forth, but the problem is, you know, people see this stuff and they go, see, it doesn't work. And the more we need to really sit down and figure out, how are these things going to be done? How do you travel to and from your district? Just like here in this state, you know, the governor ran on a platform, we're taking all the state cars away. So they said, okay, take the state cars away, pay us mileage. Now they're going, oh, gee, we made a huge mistake, because there are some people who live 300 miles from here, and they're making huge money driving back and forth.
And they failed to do a cost analysis.
And it's cost us a boatload more than it would have. You know, at some point, don't you just kind of knock your head against the wall and go, I wish that common sense would prevail. And it all comes back down to this whole lobby thing. It all comes back down to the money in this system is just, well, and speaking of money, the former aide for Senator John Ensign, he has been indicted by the feds. The guy who John Ensign, the good Christian conservative, Republican from Nevada, you know, who was, you know, the C Street guy staying in the C Street house, you know, having his little affair with some other guy's wife. The husband of this guy's mistress, has been charged with violating federal conflict laws. It's kind of interesting. The U.S. Justice Department announced that Douglas Hampton, the former aide to the GOP senator, has been indicted on 7 counts. The charges stem from violations of congressional rules that bar Senate employees from lobbying their ex-colleagues for 1 year after they stopped working in Congress. Ensign, who recently announced he wasn't going to be seeking another term, has been investigated by federal prosecutors and Senate ethics committees for actions stemming this guy's wife, an affair with this guy's wife. Prosecutors in December said that they would not charge Ensign for his role in helping Hampton obtain lobbying work. So it's kind of interesting. You know, Ensign's parents give the Hamptons $96,000 as a gift, and nobody gets charged. This whole situation just stinks to high heaven, trying to pay this guy off. It's funny, actually. In some weird, twisted, bizarre way, it's funny. What's that saying? Oh, the tangled web we weave. I don't know. Crazy, crazy stuff. The American Family Association last night we talked about, their crazy leader said that, you know, Muslims have no rights under our Constitution. Remember that guy? No rights under the Constitution because we were, you know, Christian thing. You know, that whole nonsense. Well, tonight, the Family Rights Council, another one of these radical right Christian groups, is outraged that the Obama administration sent a joint statement to the United Nations opposing the criminalization of homosexuality. So according to the crazy people at the Family Rights Council, they're calling for a resolution, Operation International Tolerance, they're angry about. He writes, while American forces bomb away at Libya, the Obama administration is launching another global offensive, Operation International Tolerance. As he looks on from South America, the president puts troops on the ground today of a meeting at the UN's Human Rights Council where his diplomats plan to strong arm another country into embracing homosexuality. And what I find funny is, you know, it's these religious people who push all this stuff. You remember Pastor James David Manning when he came on this program?
Obama!
Yeah, yeah. Remember him? accusing Obama of being a homosexual.
Yeah.
Him, Larry Sinclair.
Man loving.
Yeah. What is it with this projection that everybody else, everywhere they look, they see gay people. I remember that movie with that little kid. I see dead people. Well, these people seem to be, everywhere they look, I see gay people. It is insane.
I mean, that, what, I still remember his, you know, the intro when we interviewed him. Obama, you long-legged.
Man-loving
Mac Daddy. I mean, the man's flat on funny.
Oh, he's a comic genius.
I mean, that should be on the highlights of Comedy Central. I mean, seriously.
I love that guy.
That's really funny.
I do. I love that guy. Let's take a quick break. We're right back after this.
Noise and crowds, the freeway ride. But they slashed our funding, they cut all our hours by Washington decree. So here I stand with a long line of cars, everyone yelling at me. When did I become a problem? How did this all become online? The president says, I'm tied in the bill. The only one that's had it is mine.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Standing up to conservatives and corporatists every weeknight, The Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website, therickssmithshow.com. And now to find out what's going on in the city of Washington, our correspondent, Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service. Victoria, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you very much.
So what's going on tonight?
Well, one thing is that the president is going to speak on Monday night at 7:30. He's going to give an address at National Defense University, and he's going to talk about Libya and about the strategy. So I think, you know, they clearly felt under quite a lot of pressure to do this and knew perfectly well that they had to do it. So, and they are going to do it. So that will happen on Monday night. I think it's going to be interesting. You know, there is just so much pressure from Congress to, number one, define what the mission is. Number two, give them an exit strategy that he's going to have to say something.
Absolutely.
Also, the president and senior officials briefed a bipartisan bicameral group of members of Congress on the situation today in the Situation Room. About 20 members of Congress, senior members of Congress. About an hour, they were allowed to ask multiple questions, and they were told what the accomplishments were, what the White House says the accomplishments are, and also the transfer of power of the no-fly to NATO, and yesterday's unanimous agreement among NATO allies to direct planning for NATO to assume command and control of the civilian protection component. So they also did that.
All right. Sounds like stuff we should have done first, but at least we're doing it.
Well, this is the thing, and, you know, it's going to be difficult to recover from that.
Yep. What else is going on?
In addition, of course, things are pretty rough in terms of what is going on in the rest of the Middle East. There were really quite violent protests today in Syria and in Yemen, and the concern really is what's going to happen to the president of Yemen. He was in negotiations to step down, but now he is striking a much more defiant tone and seems to be saying that he isn't going. He did sort of say that he would go and yield to safe hands. Nevertheless, nobody really knows what that means. He's been deserted by his cabinet, by his tribe, by any number of people. But, you know, you had probably 100,000 people out there today on both sides. And the concern for the U.S. is not that Yemen has oil or anything like that. It's the most impoverished country in the Arab world. But al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula operates out of Yemen and has launched attacks against the U.S., probably three in the last two or three years. And our concern is that a power vacuum would give them an opportunity.
Yeah, so I mean, if you really wanted to make an argument, there might be a better place to go.
Yes.
And what else is going on tonight?
I think the other thing that's going on tonight is that they're getting ready for Congress to come back because Congress has been off on a week's recess, which they like to call a work period. And when it comes back, it's going to have to deal with a number of things. And one of the main things it's going to have to deal with is what to do about the continuing resolution. The government is set to shut down after April the 8th if they don't get another continuing resolution or a budget deal.
Yeah, I got to be honest. I thought it was odd that they decided to up and leave, and knowing that you had a very short period of time in order to get that passed for the rest of the year, and they chose to go anyway.
Well, this is the way that Majority Leader Eric Cantor has set things up this year. He set it up so that the House has 2 weeks' work, 1 week's recess. 2 weeks' work, 1 week's recess. That's how they now operate.
Man, to get, I wish I had a job like that.
It's not bad, is it?
It's good work if you can get it. What else is
yeah.
going on? What else are they doing?
Well, in the House, they've also got a House committee hearing on Libya, and Republicans are about to renew attacks on the AARP because of its support for the health care reform law. The Ways and Means Health and Oversight subcommittees are going to be hauling in the seniors lobby's executives for before the panel on Thursday. To basically talk about how the group stands to benefit from the law. That's what they're basically going to say. And it's going to be quite a tough hearing, I think, for the AARP.
That'll be interesting. Well, I mean, the AARP is under attack from the right as a whole. I mean, they've started their own, you know, conservative AARP. I forget what it's called, but it's I love their tagline, you know, support people who support you or something along those lines. Just nuts.
That's right. Exactly. Exactly. Well, it's been all health care all week long in the U.S., so I guess this will drag it out for another week.
Yeah, well, it gives us something to talk about.
Yeah.
What's going on in Wisconsin?
Well, this is fascinating. Professor William Cronin of the University of Wisconsin-Madison posted a piece on out-of-state think tanks and interest groups about the health care law, really saying who's really behind recent Republican legislation in Wisconsin and elsewhere. Really saying that it was David Koch and others. And he didn't expect it to go anywhere, and he was very surprised that state Republicans in Wisconsin have filed an open records request wanting to read his emails from his state university account, and they want requests covering just about everything that you could possibly imagine in terms of topics, particularly at the top, and anything references to top Republican leaders, Walker, the Fitzgerald brothers, all these other things. So in response, he posted a lengthy rebuttal on his own website. And he said he's committed no wrongdoing in terms of the use of his state email account and says it would violate federal law to reveal email conversations with students that have touched upon these subjects. And he really says it's an assault on academic freedom.
Well, of course. I mean, there's an absolute assault on education in this country by the right. Look at every one of these governors and every one of these radical states who are cutting, like here in this state, cutting $1 billion from K through 12 education, cutting higher education by 54%. They don't believe in education.
Scary stuff.
Absolutely. And what scares me more is this iron-fisted, you know, you speak out against you, we're going to come after you stuff.
Yeah, I mean, it'll be very interesting to see whether this goes anywhere. What is also interesting is that apparently the email that he where he posted this blog entry from didn't even come from his state university account. It came from his personal account.
Amazing stuff. It reminds me of back during the gubernatorial race here in Pennsylvania where our governor, Corbett, wanted to subpoena someone's Twitter account. And there's a story about the abominable snowman?
Yes, big story in the abominable snowman. They want to launch a new scientific institute dedicated to studying yetis in West Siberia. There's been a spate of reported sightings in remote areas.
Nice.
And the region's hosting an international conference on abominable snowmen later this year. The town of Tashtagol, which, of course, we've all heard of, is going to host it. And they're taking it extremely seriously. And they think the Yeti is a separate branch of human evolution. It lives in harmony with nature. And one senior scientist, researcher, says he found several artifacts to confirm his theory that they break branches to mark their territory, plans to find the shelter, and try to contact them.
Interesting. Well, I mean, at least their tourism bureau is thinking. Good for them.
Exactly. I don't know what there is to do in Western Siberia.
You got to look for the abominable snowman, if nothing else. Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service, thanks for your time. Have a great weekend.
Thank you. You too.
And now to find out what's going on here in Harrisburg. What do you got for me tonight, Jake?
Yeah, Rick, there was an important House Labor and Industry Committee hearing this week, several days ago. The House Labor and Industry Committee held a hearing on prevailing wage in Pennsylvania. Among those who testified were our, I was going to say buddy, laughingly, Matt Brulé, the Commonwealth Foundation, John Werner, Werner's Associates, and he represented both union and non-union contractors, Frank Siriani, president of the Pennsylvania State Building and Construction Trades Council, Abe Amoros of the Laborers International Union, Greg Voigt of IBEW Local 5. Brulé, in his testimony, attempted to make the case that prevailing wage laws are racist in nature and contribute to wage gaps between black and white employees. Representative Brendan Boyle refuted his accusations of racism, stating that there is no evidence of such, and the prevailing wage tax the prevailing wage has the support of African-American labor leaders. Brulé also accused prevailing wages of being inflated, which was met with a challenge from Chairman Keller, who pointed out that prevailing wages are consistent with the wages that exist in a given community. John Werner, speaking on behalf of the Sheet Metal Contractors Association, argued that the law creates a level playing field for contractors that bid on public works projects. He also made the case that prevailing wage laws favor Pennsylvania businesses and workers, as non-prevailing wage states have a much higher percentage of public construction projects being awarded to out-of-state contractors. Gene Phillips of Phillips Brothers Electrical Contractors, who joined Werner, also pointed out that the prevailing wage does not artificially inflate wages, but promotes paying what is already in the private sector as an established pay scale. Frank Siriani warned that eliminating the prevailing wage would give rise to kickbacks and worker abuse, and he pointed out the offensive nature of Boulay's earlier testimony by disclosing that the building and construction trades has the highest graduation rate of women and minorities of any apprentice program in the state. Our buddy Abe Amoros of the of LIUNA, the Laborers International Union, defended the prevailing wage by saying it provides good-paying, family-sustaining wages in addition to health care and pensions for employees, as all research refutes the claim that prevailing wage increases the cost of government construction projects. The House Labor and Industry hearings come in the wake of an onslaught of legislation recently introduced that proposes to severely inhibit the state prevailing wage or to eliminate it entirely. Some good testimony. The Commonwealth Foundation threw out their what they think are tried and true arguments against it, and I think the people from labor and some of the general contractors came out and refuted some of those charges. If you're interested in tuning in on PCN on Monday night, Rick Bloomingdale from the AFL-CIO, in fact, at 7 p.m., will be on air. It's PCN Network. If you want to call in, number is 1-877-726-5001. Marcellus Shale Advisory Commission. The governor has been adamant, Rick, about not wanting to tax Marcellus Shale natural gas companies. He left, he did leave out a little hope, and he said he's going to wait till he hears from his advisory commission. Well, that commission met. The first person to talk was Jim Crowley, who's his right-hand man. And he opened the meeting, and he talked about their vision, the administration's vision of what Pennsylvania could become in 20 or 30 years if they make the right decisions today. And that was followed by a whole host of speakers from the industry. What's interesting is when the environmentalist group, Chesapeake Bay, stood up, and the spokesperson for CBA said this, CBA would like to draw attention to the fact that Pennsylvania's recently crafted watershed implementation plan for the Chesapeake Bay total maximum daily load does not currently account for the cumulative increases in the nitrogen, phosphorus, and sediment loads generated by the natural gas industry, an emission that will need to be addressed. CBF also noticed that Department of Environmental Protection currently reviews permits for gas extraction on a permit-by-permit basis without reviewing the potential comprehensive cumulative effects resulting from an increase in sediment loads from erosion and post-construction runoff from the roads, the well pads, the pipelines, and other infrastructure. She also said the foundation is looking forward to discussing topics involving shallow gas migration, the ultimate fate and risk of contamination from frack water, documentation and tracking of wastewater products, inadequate bonding laws, setbacks, fines, well pads, siting issues, floodplain concerns, and exploration of alternative fracking methodologies that may have less environmental and health impacts and a funding source. In the end, Mr. Crowley said this. When asked about the industry-leaning makeup of the commission after the meeting, Crowley said this. This really isn't about the makeup of the commission, but the information we get, I suspect and hope we will hear even more from environmentalists. When asked if there would be an opportunity for the public to at least observe or listen to the meetings of the working group, his answer was, I'm sure that remains to be seen. When you have a makeup of 3-1, and I'm talking about industry representatives compared to public interest groups and environmentalist groups, I'm a little bit skeptical. Those are heavy odds for something constructive for the taxpayers of Pennsylvania, and we'll have to wait and see, Rick, but I'm very skeptical of this. I think this was basically set up to cover the governor's behind, to be perfectly honest.
Yeah, I agree. Let's take a quick break right back after this to wrap things up. This is the Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
Do you need a sign or promotional material for your business, campaign, or function? Then All Union Signs and Promos is the place for you. For years, All Union Signs and Promos has been serving South Central Pennsylvania with affordable, high-quality, union-made and American-made signs and promotional products. We want you to be seen. We set ourselves apart not only by being your one-stop, full-service sign shop, but also being able to tie that image into a full line of promotional products. Our dedicated staff will print, design, and deliver your most effective advertising tool on time and on budget. If you have a message, we have a sign. When you need your name on it, All Union Signs and Promos will do it with a memorable and unique union-made and American-made product. For more information about union-made and American-made products, visit our website at allunionsigns.com. That's allunionsigns.com. Or give us a call at 717-221-8888. 888.
Is that old washer or dryer on the fritz and you don't have the bucks for a new one?
Call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
You say that old refrigerator isn't refrigerating so well.
Call Mike at Klein's, 243-3211.
How about a bunch of money to replace your old stove or microwave?
Again, save the cost of a new one. Just call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Here at the radio station, we call Mike our resident mechanical and electronics genius. Have you ever met someone who can literally fix anything? That's Mike.
Call him at 243-3211.
You'd be amazed to learn how well many of the older appliances were made. A simple repair might give you another 5, 10, or even 20 years of service from that old washer, dryer, stove, or refrigerator at a fraction of the cost of a new one. Mike repairs TVs and electronics, too.
So call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Let Mike fix it right, and you pocket the savings.
That's 243-3211 for Mike at Klein's Appliances Repair Service.
Your proud defender of the working class majority, Rick Smith.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. From there, you can download our podcast. If you missed any portion of the program, you can also email me, Rick at thericksmithshow.com. If you've got any questions, comments, something on your mind. Also, remember, on Monday, 11:30 a.m., the Capitol steps here in Harrisburg. The bunch of college kids, professors, citizen activists, and, you know, people who are concerned at the direction of the state with regard to education. And what I'm hoping is that we don't get into this pitting group against group. The moneyed interests have done such a masterful job of slicing and dicing the working class of this country that we shouldn't be doing it to ourselves. You know, I don't want to pit, you know, kindergartners against college kids, granny against infants. I don't want to get into that. We need to be talking about raising revenue. We don't have a spending problem. What we have is we have a revenue problem. If you go back and you look at the tax codes of years past, you look at the division of the wealth of this country in years past, you will realize quickly that it is a revenue problem. And you look at the Wall Street Journal that reported last Friday that CEO bonuses at the 50 major companies soared by over 30% last year. Over 30%. They got 30% raises. Everybody else, well, what'd you get? Most of the people I know, big tax, big wage concessions, freezes, paying more for your health care, getting less benefits. But the CEO folks doing very well. The big winner among the CEOs evidently is a guy named Daniel Eustain. He is the chief executive of Navistar. Navistar is a global truck maker. Now, look, during this economic downturn, how many trucks do you think they're making? I would say not an awful lot. He got a bonus of just about $4 million last year, a bonus. And you go, well, gee, if the truck industry's down, we aren't selling as many trucks, and we live in this grand meritocracy, what prompted this guy to get this $4 million bonus? Well, to his credit, if you look at it this way, he was able to develop a model that kept his company profitable in the midst of the worst truck market in 50 years. That's the reporting of the Wall Street Journal. The model, you ask? What model? What did this innovative CEO do? What did this great mind, what did this person worth $4 million in bonus money, what did he do? What did he invent? How did he do it? Please tell. Well, he went back. He went old school, if you will. He cut health benefits for retirees. He laid off active workers. And he strong-armed local communities into giving them bigger tax breaks. So you look at this and you go, well, that's not all that innovative. In fact, that's pretty bad for our our society. It's pretty bad for our economy. Understand, these people don't care about any of that stuff. You know what they care about, Jake? $4 million in bonus money in their pocket. I don't care about Joe, the truck mechanic. Don't care about the guy who washes the windows. Don't care about the guy who puts the tires on the truck or delivers them. Don't care about any of those people whatsoever. What the CEO cares about, his own bonus money and maximizing shareholder wealth. So cut costs at all possibilities. Everywhere where there's an ounce of fat, you whack it off with not a scalpel. You whack it off with a nice sharp axe. And take a whole bunch of muscle with it too. Because the more you can cut, the more profit there is. There's more shareholder wealth there, which means more bonus.
Well, it wasn't that long ago, you know, when I was young, you know, when the dinosaurs ruled the earth, you'll probably say. But truthfully, at one time, Rick, when companies laid people off or you know, let them go, that was a negative in Wall Street. Now, that's a big plus to the stock.
That must have been a long time ago that it was a negative, because I got to be honest.
Yes, it was.
At least as long as we've been doing this program. At least as long as we've been doing this. Every time you see a company announce a layoff, the stock price is jumping.
No, I'm talking back 50s and 60s.
And if you remember, you go back to the whole Ford, the whole auto industry argument that, can you believe they have workers who sit in a room and don't get working, and they pay. They get paid. They don't work. They get paid. Let me let you in on a little something. See, this was a very forward-thinking idea that those workers were part of that company, that they were entitled to be part of the company, of the wealth that they created. So when a company hired someone, they didn't just discard them. There was a partnership there. Today, we don't seem to believe in that partnership. And you look what New Hampshire just did. They just passed a law making New Hampshire an at-will state, which means their workers are garbage. Their workers can be discarded at any time for any reason. Simple. So, you know, I look back to that, Jake, and I look back to that auto industry program that was there that said, you know what? Ford, GM, Chrysler, and it should have been Toyota, Honda, all of them who had to go along. If you hire somebody, you're responsible for them. You can't just throw them to the curb like trash.
Well, here's the irony. You talk to Toyota, you realize in Japan that had been the model. I can't honestly say it still is, but for a long, long time in Japan, the Japanese companies extended every effort to make sure that only as a last resort they laid employees off.
In Japan,
most employees when they got hired by a major Japanese company worked for that company their whole work life.
And, you know, the Germans were, you know, the same way. In Germany, when they come here, boy, they exploit the worst possible things because we have got the worst laws. We are in desperate need of labor law reform. I want to thank all of our guests for today, all week long. It's been a great week of shows. Thank you for being here. Again, if you missed any portion of the program or any portion of the week's program or the last 6 months or a couple of years, we've got them all archived there at therickSmithShow.com. You can download them for your convenience or, you know, just a fact check. I mean, keep me on my toes. If you want to email me, Rick@therickSmithShow.com.